And it's not the sacrifice. You can't get that into your head, can you? You've stated a half a dozen times the MBE is irrelevant. I agree. It was no sacrifice to get rid of the MBE because it was an embarrassment.
Then what kind of a protest did you make? You said,
advertising campaign for peace. Can you understand that?
No, I can't.
A very big advertising campaign for peace.
I think it's self-vulgar and self-aggrandizing. Well, you think it's... Are you advertising John Lennon or peace?
Do you want nice middle-class gestures for peace?
Maybe.
And intellectual manifestos written by a lot of half-witted intellectuals and nobody reads them? Oh. That's the trouble with the peace movement.
It's Friday. It's 3 minutes past five. This is Bristol. It's not the only time you're going to hear that tonight, I hope. It's World War III, week 15, and welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 12th of June 2026, streaming live from the Coombe Centre, close by the Bristol City Centre itself. And don't believe a word we say, but do try to share moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar port turned merchant venture of fiefdom. This is our local Illuminati, by the way. If you check them out, the merchant venturers, totally unaccountable, own the city, actually own vast amounts of wealth all over the Western world, but we're not allowed to know where it is because they're constituted under a royal charter. Only the Privy Council is allowed to know about that. No journalists, no politicians, nobody, actually not even lawyers are allowed to know apart from the Privy Council. Funny that, isn't it? In the City of London's Empire of Lies. Bristol's only national news show is coming to you live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, on holylandradio.com, 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store at thisweek.org.uk, but not the evil Google Play. This show repeats at 11 p.m. On Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. Yesterday I was there, so you're getting a double dose of me, you poor people. Tonight we'll be hearing from Robert Olds from the Bruges Group. This is a group which had its founding president as Margaret Thatcher, no less, as a group to make sure that Britain kept its sovereignty. And we're talking to him because we're announcing the sad death last week of Rowan Atkinson's brother, Rodney Atkinson, who was a big campaigner for Brexit. He did a video called Brexit or Die, for example. And we'll be hearing a bit of an extract from that. But also, more importantly, Robert Olds will be talking about what Rodney Atkinson's contribution has been over the years. Someone who's entirely cancelled by people that hate people with those sorts of ideas. We'll also be hearing from Chris Williamson, the former Labour MP, what he makes of Andy Burnham as a potential new Prime Minister and winner of the Makerfield by-election pantomime show. But he's most concerned about the domestic policy of Andy Burnham, in that he doesn't seem to have any real understanding of economics and how to fix the cost of living crisis, which is like the number one issue for most British people. We'll be also hearing from someone called Uwe Alschner. He's a German researcher who's been looking into the movements of Adolf Hitler in the run-up to the First World War, his crimes over in Vienna, and his little trips over to the UK, Dartmouth, possibly Tavistock, Dartmoor, and Liverpool. Adolf Hitler roaming around before World War One here, what was he up to and why? I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero trust agenda psyops, being very careful about what they don't tell you. Those bins in those newsrooms are where all the interesting stuff is, because they ain't telling us nothing we really need to know. And what they do tell us is really just to try and make us think that they're being frank and honest with us. Nick Land's social Darwinists and Albert Pike's Zionist Armageddon plan want us as slaves to their AI or dead. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British public, as do the City of London and all those behind the royalty, as well as Iran, China, Russia, the Bricks and anyone that's not in their little death cult. Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, although it was planning to, and the only right they want us to have is the right to kill ourselves, it seems. Hitler was the prototype, now the chaos lord Netanyahu's rolling out a red carpet for the Zionist Antichrist man-god messiah to come, maybe. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Martin, let's start off by talking about the riots over in Belfast this week. I don't think anyone was really expecting this. There was a court case running about a Sudanese man who'd attacked someone with a knife, and he's been charged now with attempted murder. And there's been very little talk about the run-up to this attack. So I very much doubt it was an unprovoked attack. I mean, we just do not know. But there have been protests about outside this guy's asylum hostel in Belfast for many weeks.
Well, I mean, there's been ongoing protests since, if you remember, this time last year, particularly in the northern part of Northern Ireland, the very northern part, I'm trying to remember the name of it.
Well,
now.
And Southern Ireland too, let's be fair.
Yes,
there's lots
true,
in
yeah.
Dublin too.
Yes, and there's been lots on this side of the Irish Sea as well. So we've been. This has been an ongoing thing. And of course, any incident like this
ongoing
one.
Ongoing since when?
Well, ongoing since we've been arguing about asylum and migration, which has been quite a long time. You know, there's been a lot. There's been an issue for a while, hasn't it?
Mass migration, I think it's fair to say, is something that was begun under Blair and Cameron. It really accelerated under Cameron. It seems to me the main object of it is it's actually nothing to do with granting people asylum. A lot of it is to do with low wages. And Cameron, of course, and the Conservative government were looking for bringing in people into the care services, the hospital services, etc., to force wages down, weren't they?
Asylum seekers
were they or not?
No,
they weren't.
No,
okay.
They weren't.
Why were they bringing those people in?
Let's go.
Why were they granting all these work visas, why were they granting all those work visas?
Work visas aren't given to asylum seekers.
No, I didn't say
basic
they were.
Fact.
But why were they? Why were they?
Right.
Granting
so we're talking about asylum
visas?
Seekers or people on work visas.
If you just, you're not actually listening, are you? Do you want to listen or not? I did ask you a question about work visas.
All right, so we're not talking about asylum seekers then?
I was asking you a question about work visas.
All right, work visas. Let's talk about work visas.
Yeah, they started, well, as I'm saying,
under
Cameron.
Tony.
Martin, we're not stupid, yeah?
No.
So don't treat us like idiots. The work visa thing started under Blair, and it was really accelerated under Conservative government of David Cameron. That's when most of these work visas were granted.
Yes, so we've granted loads of work visas.
And was this a good thing to do?
Well, at the time, people presumed that if we wanted to staff the National Health Service without raising wages, then we would have to bring people
in
to do that.
There's the key point, isn't it? So is this actually about cheap labour and all of this?
Yes, but the National Health Service, don't forget, doesn't work for a profit. So if you're going to pay higher wages, there has to be higher taxes on wealthy people, and obviously we can't do that.
Or higher spending and borrowing.
Yes, or higher spending and borrowing, which we can't do because obviously we've got to
yes,
balance the books, Tony.
Yeah, we can, because you know we don't have to balance
no,
the books.
No, I know, I'm just saying what the argument was.
Yeah, well, that was the argument, but it seems to have... I mean, there is a whole business of asylum seekers as well, which is absolutely... In fact, this guy was, I believe, an asylum seeker. He was a policeman over in Sudan. Who was being threatened over there.
Yes.
So it might well be that he was unfairly treated over in Belfast by some of the locals were blaming him for David Cameron and the Conservative Party's policies.
Yeah, but don't forget he came through the asylum route, right? He wasn't in work. He was an asylum seeker.
Well, this is what I just said.
Yes.
They're blaming him as a legitimate asylum seeker for this mass migration, which is largely economic.
Yes, well, in actual fact, in Northern Ireland, they've got the lowest proportion of people who are not born in Northern Ireland in any part of the UK or Ireland, the Southern Ireland. In actual fact, a lot of this is being driven by loyalist ideology. They just don't like foreigners.
Well, I noticed the local people in Belfast where this attack took place. One of the first things we saw at the beginning of this week was a message that went out from the Shankill Road from the loyalist communities saying, would you like us to come and help you put down this immigrant...
Yes, in actual fact, I don't understand the full details, Tony. I have tried to follow it, but obviously the police aren't giving all the full details. But I think this attack took place in what is essentially a Republican area. Not least, I thought that, because the guy who whacked him over the head was whacking him over the head with a hurley stick. And, of course, loyalists don't play hurley. So it's likely that this was in a Republican part of West Belfast. But the rioting has all been in loyalist parts of West Belfast and also around Northern Ireland. because they don't forget they burned loads of people out this time last year. Yeah,
what for?
For just being foreigners. They don't want foreigners in Northern Ireland. The Loyalists have never, they don't like Catholics, they don't like the Irish, and they don't
actually,
like
actually, the Catholics are not foreigners, are they? They were there before the Loyalists
and
indeed, the Unionists.
So maybe the Loyalists have to go somewhere else then, eh? What about that?
It's not a very clever idea, is it, to be burning people out of their houses? I mean, it seems to me all the focus is on the asylum seekers and the migrants on the ground, and none on the individual politicians, etc., who have caused this.
Well, it's a complicated issue. The politicians have responsibility, but of course people feel that somebody's in a house that they want. And of course this is what happened at the beginning of the Troubles in 1969. Loads of Catholic families were driven out of their homes, burned out of their homes by Loyalist mobs. The difference being, in 1969, the police helped the Loyalists to do it.
One of the more sinister parts of the rioting in Belfast has been a long list of home addresses that had been collated by somebody and shared on social media of migrants.
That's right, and of course there were human rights groups like Amnesty International who alerted the police to the circulation of these addresses. So the police were aware that this might happen. And of course, an incident like this is going to happen sooner or later, and then of course it's used as an excuse by those who want to have an excuse to go out and do what they want to do.
The PSNI found evidence of social media coordination from inside and outside Northern Ireland. Now I wonder if somebody like Elon Musk might have played a hand here, his little algorithms boosting up incitement to riot. He's already said, hasn't he, in public in Britain that there are going to be riots. Then
yes.
Maybe he's inciting
well,
them.
Well, he personally waded in and said he was in favour of what was going on and he thought it was necessary and all the rest of it. Very helpful.
So, ultimately, though, of course, there are all sorts of resentments caused by the economy, a collapsing economy. Isn't it fair to say that many people who live in Belfast are concerned about the cost of living and that this is almost like an outlet, is somebody to blame, to point the finger at, as the politicians aren't available to riot at?
Well, yes, and of course we're going to get lots more of this as the economy gets... Well, the economy's just started to shrink, and of course economies don't just shrink a bit. When they start shrinking, especially in a situation like we're in global terms, it's likely to go down and down and down. So there's going to be plenty of things for people to get upset about. And, of course, there are rational solutions to this, and there are irrational
ones.
Well,
there's one person who has got upset with what's going on, particularly with the migrants, not necessarily with the rioting so much, although I imagine he may decide to condemn it, and that is the Restore Britain's Rupert Lowe.
The scale of illegal immigration and its impact on our country is simply not understood in this Parliament, nor do most members even care. British people are genuinely scared. Women are frightened to go into their towns alone. Parents are terrified to let their children walk to school. It's getting worse and worse and worse. The British people are not stupid. They can see their communities radically changing, and they can feel their streets becoming more unfamiliar, more dangerous, more menacing. All whilst the Home Office deliberately conceals the true extent of the change from our citizens. I am contacted by dozens and dozens of women who genuinely fear for their lives, and they feel ignored by this place, ignored by those who are supposed to represent and protect them, ignored and abandoned, thrown to the wolves in pursuit of some sick multicultural experiment that is being forced on our people. One that has very real-world consequences. What happened just yesterday? Two Afghan illegal migrants jailed for raping a schoolgirl. The footage exists. She filmed herself during the rape. Even the men's barrister warned it would lead to disorder if it was released, as it was so horrific. "You're going to rape me," the girl cried as she was dragged away. She screamed for help and begged not to be taken. One of the migrants gagged her with his hand. The Afghan men forced her to perform sex acts in a secluded area. She is heard screaming for help. She calls for her friends. She wants to go home. She's pleading for help from passers-by. None came. Can you imagine her horror, her fear, her desperation? Think, if it was your daughter, how would that make you feel? Honestly, think about that.
With the honourable man.
The girl was then pushed to her knees before being brutally raped. Another, one of too many. Last year, a 35-year-old Iranian small boat migrant raped a 15-year-old girl in an alleyway. He was known to police in Germany, where he was convicted of assault offences. He told the girl she could be his sex doll and that he wanted to, and I quote, fuck her, before dragging her down an alleyway, forcing her to her knees outside a secluded doorway, and then raping her. The poor girl's anguished mother later asked, why was he in this country? A question millions and millions of British people are asking. Why are they here? These are unimaginable horrors, but they are happening right across our country every day, brutally and relentlessly. This House may not like to hear this, but it must listen. It must understand, it must digest. This is a political choice, and it's one that this Parliament has made. These are men who should never have been in our country to begin with. They should have been detained, and they should have been deported, indiscriminately and without question. They weren't. They were housed, fed, and cared for at taxpayer expense, released onto our streets, allowed to roam freely. Thousands and thousands of them, unvetted foreign men from barbaric cultures that have no place in our communities. Words cannot adequately describe my disgust for what has been forced onto the British people. Since being elected, I have used what little influence I hold to try and uncover the impact of these migrants and just how severely the British people are suffering because of it. I've asked over 600 questions of the Home Office. I received very few answers, particularly when the question is regarding illegal migrants. No data, not centrally collected, and disproportionate costs are often cited. I thought perhaps incompetence, but evidence has come to my attention that proves that the Home Office has been misleading MPs. On January the 20th, I asked the Home Office this question. What information the department holds on the number of irregular migrants defined as absconders?
Rupert Lowe there from Restore Britain. He's one of the parties in the Makerfield by-election. We've got the cost of living crisis as a major issue, a potential war with Russia and Iran as another major issue, but then the cost of living crisis. For many people, it's almost as if this is becoming a big issue because of all the violence and the press coverage that's come with it, Martin.
Well, that's right. And of course, he mentioned two individual cases there, one an Iranian man and one an Afghani man. Can I point out that Britain still has sanctions on Iran, sanctions on Afghanistan? We invaded Afghanistan and spent 4 to 20 year war in Afghanistan. It's absolutely devastated the place, cost us loads of money. And of course, we shouldn't have gone. Nor should we have sanctions on Iran, nor should our air force being used at the minute to help the Americans and the Israelis to attack Iran. Why are these migrants here? It's because we, Rupert Lowe and the Conservative Party, voted for all of those wars. He was in favour of them all. And that's why these people are here. We shouldn't have started those wars. We shouldn't have gone into Iraq. We shouldn't have gone into Libya. We should have minded our own business.
Certainly,
but we didn't.
It's
did
certainly
we?
Why those the Sudanese guy in Belfast was here. This is a bit more up to date. This is just yesterday from Rupert Lowe. Restore Britain.
Our establishment, and that goes for obviously all those people responsible for this mass untargeted immigration, which has resulted in people who are culturally incompatible being settled across Britain, not integrating, and basically damaging our high trust communities, which have been built up over many centuries and which operated extremely well. This was a Sudanese man in Belfast who came into the UK He was allowed in by Robert Jenrick and Suella Braverman, who were Immigration Minister and Home Secretary at the time. They're now Reform MPs, and this fellow, as many others have, exploited our soft border with Ireland. So, Restore Britain, I want to underline this morning the three things that we intend to do. The first is to abolish the entire asylum system while we clean up the catastrophic legacy of uncontrolled immigration. The second thing we intend to do is to deport all illegal migrants and those who shouldn't be here in the first place. And the third thing we intend to do is to have a binding referendum on the reintroduction of the death penalty to purge the system of this pervasive evil for good. And obviously that will be up to the British people as to whether they pursue the third part of our plan, but we will be working and lobbying for that outcome. So I think what we've had is a catastrophic failure of those in positions of influence and power. They all need to be held to account. They all need to be responsible for what they have done to Britain, the evil that they perpetrated on our people, on the innocent, taxpaying, decent British people. Our judiciary doesn't work anymore. Our police force doesn't work anymore. The Home Office doesn't work anymore. The civil service doesn't work anymore. Parliament's been hollowed out. And it's time that we actually had some radical change and that we restored a democratic rule to our country. And we held people accountable for failure. And that is not happening at the moment.
Restore Britain means restoring democracy, apparently.
Yeah, like we've always had democracy, and we got taken away from us. We've never really had democracy in this country. That's why there was a war in Ireland, because there wasn't any real democracy. And, of course, we're not a high-trust community, necessarily. It depends where you live, doesn't it?
What do you mean? Well, what's wrong with saying it's a high-trust community?
Some communities are high-trust, some are less.
Well, if rates of violent crime are going up, it's becoming a low-trust...
In actual fact, rates of violent crime are going down. And, of course, immigration is going down. But you wouldn't know that from listening to Rupert. Roberts, or whatever his name, Rupert.
It's Rupert. What do you think's going on with him and Farage? Because it does seem as if the idea is his party has been created, and interesting influences such as the guy we heard about last couple of weeks, Frank Wright, seem to have just sort of popped up at the right moment, say the right things. And it's quite clear. I mean, he is already causing major problems for Farage.
Well, it's because of the first past the post system means that if anybody splits your left or your right,
what extent is this just Farage's ego, and to what extent is this a deliberate attempt, as Farage's party starts to look as if it might be able to form a majority in a general election, suddenly this guy has come to spike his guns?
Well, you can't stop people forming political parties if that's what they want to do. Jeremy Corbyn formed his own one in the end, and that's what people do.
And what about the money behind these things, though?
Oh, well, that is interesting, isn't it? Because Restore and Reform are getting pots and pots of money from the likes of Elon Musk and others from outside the country. Well, there you are. Why are these foreigners so interested in pushing this kind of point of view down our throat?
Well, maybe it was because there really is very little democracy left here. What's your general thoughts about Makerfield? Because it does, I mean, I looking at it, it just seems to be a bit of a pantomime.
Well, it's the most consequential by-election since World War II.
Well, they always say that.
I think it is, Tony. I mean, it's not exaggerated to say that. If Andy Burnham doesn't win and Reform win, then obviously that puts them set fair to win a general election in 3 years' time, which is going to be after the crash and the World War, so let's not talk too much about general elections. That's a long way in the future. But, of course, it will then disorganise the progressive forces in the country quite dramatically. If he wins, then a whole race begins to remove Keir Starmer and replace him. So it's going to have a big effect one way or the other. That's why everybody's concerned about it and what's going to happen there.
There's a bit of a split in the polls over whether or not Burnham looks like a prime ministerial material. Britons tend to believe Andy Burnham has done a good job as mayor of Greater Manchester, by 44% to 12%. 71% of people who live in the northwest of England think Burnham has done as well as the mayor of Manchester. Public are split 33-33 on whether Burnham looks like a PM in waiting.
Well, obviously, there's a big step up from being the mayor of a major region to being the prime minister. And he's got to make that case if that's what he wants to do. But he's also, the first thing he's got to do is win the by-election. And, of course, we've got splits on the left. So the Greens and the Liberal Democrats will be standing against him, and they may take quite a few of his votes. So it's going to be a bit of a lottery like these first-past-the-post elections can be. It's quite easily possible that whoever wins won't have a majority of the vote.
Is there going to be electoral pacts, do you think, or the left or right?
Well,
these can happen just before the vote, can't they?
They can. I think at the minute it's so hard to, you can see everybody's in a febrile mood. Nobody really wants to be team players. So it's going to be very difficult for either the right or the left to make electoral pacts. It's going to be up to the voters to decide what they think. It's tactical voting becomes essential in first-past-the-post elections. So, for example, if you're a Green voter, you may decide, look, if I vote Green, that's effectively a vote for Farage, which it is in this context. Or it might be. If the Greens were ahead, as they were in Gorton, then obviously the calculation changes the other way. And people who might have voted Labour vote Green, because that's the way to best beat Farage. And the same goes on the other side. You know, if Restore Britain want Farage, they've fallen out pretty badly, Rupert Lowe and Nigel Farage. I mean, Nigel Farage is quite a difficult character, and he's fallen out with people. And then, of course, they don't want to do what you want them to do because you've fallen out with them.
Also, of course, it is possible, right, to leave that till the last minute, to look at how the voting is playing out in the polls and say, well, like, just a few days before, right, I'm standing down, I'm not going to be a candidate.
Yeah, but your name will still be on the ballot paper. What happened in 1980 in Northern Ireland with the by-election that led to the victory of Bobby Sands is that they made sure, because you can withdraw some days, but once they printed the ballot papers, you can't withdraw. Yeah, you're on the ballot paper, so you can say, I'm not standing, don't vote for me, but nevertheless the ballot paper will have your name on it. Now this is not necessarily impossible barrier for people to get through. People who are interested in politics follow it to the extent where they realise what's going on. We shall have to see how it plays out. But however the vote plays out in this by-election, we can look closely to see whether the left or the right got most votes.
Who do you think is going to win?
I think it's probably, my money would be on Andy Burnham, but it's going to be close, I would suggest.
Let's have a listen to, this is Andy Burnham himself. This is the guy you think might be about to take over. Let's have a listen to Victoria Derbyshire grilling him, particularly on things like his economic policy.
Why do you think it is that trade union members are as likely to support reform as Labour?
Well, that's not my experience.
Okay,
and we'll have to see how that plays out.
Well, looking at that poll, why do you think that is?
Because I think people are working people first and trade unions second. And I think working people are recognising that they're working so hard and they're not getting ahead. You know, the government's taking more of their taxes and you don't see what, you can't get a GP appointment, the streets aren't safe, the borders aren't safe. Their children can't buy housing.
You were going to raise the personal threshold to 20 grand and then you turned on that. So you're not going to help in that respect.
I mean, I think policy changes all the time to adapt to the economic situation. But I think fundamentally, people don't vote on the old lines, Labour or Conservative. They vote on issues. And the issue right now is that there's no growth in the economy. People are working so hard and they see that the welfare state is growing and people are being punished and not rewarded for going out there and working.
As a Labour man, are you pleased that Restore could end up splitting the vote on the right?
I don't think it's about them. I think it's about Labour getting their platform together. What happens in the right-wing factions is up to them. You've got the hard right, militant right in Reform, and the ultra-right under the other party. Reform's going to find that harder because as they try to appeal to the centre to consolidate their vote, they're going to have to try and stretch their blanket to cover these ultra-right nationalists that are represented by Rupert Lowe. They're all despicable as far as I'm concerned, and working class people should turn away from them.
They should
turn away from that, the hatred that is being spread.
What hatred?
Nigel Farage has spent his time spreading hatred in this country.
Your party believes
in mass deportations
of illegal migrants
living in this country.
What's the problem with that?
You said of people that are not illegal migrants, of any economic migrant that is living, is getting the benefit of the welfare system.
But because there is a fundamental principle, and you tell me if you believe it
or not. So if you get unemployed as an immigrant, you're going to be deported.
Do you believe in this fundamental principle that social housing and benefits should be for the British people? Do you believe that?
And the British people includes people that live here that have come from abroad.
So do you believe they are the British people? Well, they're not British. If they are not British... nationals, they are not British. Do you believe that
fundamentally?
Do you believe that British trade unions who work hard should be paying for people who have arrived to live in social housing?
What we believe in is we pay for each other through a fair tax system.
In which country
can wealth is distributed properly so that all people could advance?
But
you believe in isolating people and taking advantage of poverty so that you can divide them and make your friends even richer.
So are you a Mick Lyncher or a Layla Cunningham, Martin? There's nothing to do with Andy. We've also got a clip with Andy Burnham as well coming up in a minute. But that's Layla Cunningham and Mick Lynch, the leader of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers.
Yeah, well, I mean, I broadly agree with Mick Lynch. I very rarely disagree with him about most things, so there you are.
What about the effect of... I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, really, that unions would support, any trade union would support cheap migrant labour being brought in, and he's actually defending it there.
No, what he's saying is that when people arrive here, and don't forget, they start paying taxes as soon as they go to work... They're paying into the system. In actual fact, migrant labourers pay into the system because they generally tend to be younger. They're paying into the fiscal system. And it's actually people like myself, who's a white pensioner, who's taking the money out.
But no one's taking your job, are they?
I haven't got a job anymore.
There's no swapping of a job going on with you, Martin. Let's just also look at the amount of tax that's being paid. If you're a better paid local person that's got the job, and that job is then taken by a migrant, first of all, there's less tax being paid, not more, when this person starts working, and also, of course, the actual the benefits have then got to be paid to the person who's been made out of work. So of course it's not good for the economy at all.
Well, the reason why we brought lots of people in on visas, and it's because they've got jobs offered to them by private employers.
That's
and
right.
By the health service.
It's very good for the businesses involved. It looks very good on their books.
It looks very good for the National Health Service as well in terms of balancing their books.
Yes,
Tony.
Of course. That's what I said. And the nation and the welfare bill picks up the bill, doesn't it?
Well, what we should have done is, if we go back to the 1950s, the top rate of tax was 95%. We didn't have any...
Well, this is not talking about low-paid workers.
No.
You're just changing the subject.
No, because you're trying to make it all about the labour market, and it's actually about macroeconomics, which is about the whole economy. It's not just
I'm just looking at the labour market specifically.
Yes, I know.
This idea that Mick Lynch is saying there, that it's actually good to be bringing people in...
He didn't say
because
it was good.
He didn't say that.
What he said was, anybody who's working here should join their trade union, and I agree with that. Yeah. And everybody should be on a union rate. I agree with that. And anybody who breaks union rates should be... they're scabs, shouldn't they? They shouldn't be employed by anybody. No employer should be allowed to employ anybody.
Have you noticed how few people are in unions these days?
That's because the private sector
has been undermining unions for years.
Yes,
and one of the ways they do it is they sack union activists and they bring in people who are prepared to work for less and are not politically
yes,
active.
Yes, and of course what the union activists have been trying to do with those people for years, if you bother to get involved in it, is to try and get those people organised. In Australia and the United States and other countries where they've had lots of immigration over the years, Canada as well, if you're going to have people coming in, and those countries have had loads of people coming in, you've got to get them organised. That's really essential. And that means that the government's got to be behind getting them organised. Now, if they get organised in the health service and go on strikes, they have, the government has to pay the money. It's not the private sector employers, because they'll only pay... You see, a lot of it has been privatised, like the care system and so on. It's private companies who are now picking all that up. Never used to be the case. By the way, of course, all run by the government in the 1950s. So they pick up so the private sector employers, they will not pay more than the government will pay them to pay the workers. So the answer to this is nationalise all of these things, like care homes and so on, should be run by the local authorities. B, get everybody unionised. C, you're going to have to pay for it somehow. You could just print the money, or you could tax people like Nigel Farage much harder than they get taxed now to pay for it. And you should be honest to people. They've run around the Makerfield by-election. Some people did a survey this week of social attitudes. And in Makerfield, 70% plus believe that they need increased taxes on wealthy people. So whoever comes out with that at the next election is going to do
what
well.
What about taxes on the mega corporations?
The mega corporations are owned by the wealthy people. That's the point.
But the corporation, the reason they're wealthy is because these corporations are making so much money and hardly being taxed. They move their assets around the world wherever they feel is going to pay less tax, and that's why they're wealthy. It doesn't matter how much money you take off of those people, they're still going to be wealthy because their businesses are hardly taxed.
No, that's right. What we need to have is turnover taxes based on what we think your turnover is. It shouldn't be on profits. And, of course, we should have land taxes because every business has to be physically based somewhere. Yeah. So, for example, lots of corporations are based in Dublin because they can get away with paying low taxes. That's why they're in Dublin.
There already are land taxes. That's called business rates.
Yes, it's not enough. We need to actually tax land and property and wealth.
What, the farmers too? Then that means they'll go out of business, doesn't
it? Yeah, well, maybe we can get food cheaper from other countries.
Maybe those big corporations can come and buy up that land and put robots to grow food.
Maybe we
can get rid of all those farmers.
Maybe what we need to do is get rid of private property altogether, Tony. And after we've had a massive crash, which we're going through now, and these corporations, many of them will go bust. We've got this big IPO of Starlink today. Yeah. What will happen with that, in my view, is it will go bust and everybody will lose money. That's what's going to happen. And at that point, you can take it over for nothing. So all these big corporations are going to go bust in the crash, and we're not going to pay to take them over. We're just going to take them over.
Yeah, you shouldn't actually have to pay anyway. You can just legislate to nationalise them. It's whether you choose to fight a court case over to whether they get compensation or not.
Because we've got all these WTO rules and all the rest of it, which are all, in fact, the WTO
It seems to me the World Economic Forum way of doing things is going to be very, very difficult for governments or politicians anywhere to overturn this effectively a fascist system where you've got big companies owning and controlling much of our infrastructure, many of the markets, many natural monopoly markets, and also, of course, having the ear of government, the whip hand when it comes to lobbying. We've got Starmer himself saying, I much prefer chatting with the World Economic Forum than I do debating in Westminster.
Yes, that's all true, and that's why we're in the situation we're in. But, of course, if these companies go bust in a major crash, then in actual fact you can take them over for nothing. And we should be talking about this now.
Martin, this isn't really going to happen with BP or Shell, these monopolistic companies that got, I mean, BP particularly, didn't it, got privatised.
Yes.
They are actually coining it. There's no way they're going bust because they're controlling markets.
No.
Yes, they are. The supermarkets are not going to go. The supermarkets are making massive profits too.
Okay, that's true, but the banks are going to go bust. Because they're the ones that earned all the money.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, in any case, the point is
that banks just make up money.
As you say, Tony, we don't actually have to have a crash. We could just decide we're taking them over anyway. But I say they're probably going to need a crash because it's only then that you've got the head of steam to do the necessary stuff.
Maybe,
New Deal only came about in the US because of the stock market crash in 1929. Otherwise, it would never have happened. And, of course, the real problem for the powers that be in the West is that other powerful countries like Russia, China, and now Iran, they don't run it like that at all. And you're actually in direct competition with them for controlling the world. And when we go down, they won't go down.
We're actually not in competition with China and Russia at all because they have beaten us.
They've beaten us.
These two supposedly communist countries, which are actually, of course, operating a much more efficient form of capitalism, we have conked out. And so that's why I think we're resorting to aggression and war against Russia and China is because we've lost and we're bad losers.
Well, that's right. And the ruling class have basically bet on the wrong horses, but they've made loads of money at it.
Well, that's right. They were just being greedy. Let's have a little listen to Andy Burnham, because I think it's important to hear what he's got to say, because Victoria Derbyshire on Newsnight did address some pretty good questions to him, and he sounds a bit Starmer-like to me. See what you think.
Why do you believe you would be a better Prime Minister than Keir Starmer?
I am not getting into that.
Why not?
Fully focused on this by-election because it's disrespectful, actually, to the decision that people here are making. I'm making no assumptions at all about what happens after the 18th of June. And the reason I say that and this is something that anybody who lives in this constituency will know, is that this is a tight contest. There is still so much to play for in this race. It's actually been a really great experience, to be honest. Just fantastic that this area has the national spotlight on it, that you're here, that we're talking about the issues of this constituency.
After you said last night you would seek to take part in any potential Labour leadership contest, Number 10 put out a statement saying the Prime Minister will not walk away from the mandate he was given 2 years ago to build a stronger, fairer Britain. Are you ready to take on the Prime Minister?
Well, this is why I'm saying in this interview, I'm not making any assumptions. We'll see what happens after the 18th of June, win or lose. I don't know where I will be, because this is a tight by-election. People are still kind of weighing up the position, the candidates.
Okay.
And it's really important for me to... I think it's disrespectful, actually, to the voters here.
I understand that, and people hear you, because you've made that point.
Because you're assuming that is... But
I'm not assuming anything.
Interview to door-knocking...
I understand.
..knocking on the doors of undecided voters. So that's where it is right now.
OK, what's your plan?
To try and win this by-election. Simple.
OK, what about your plan for the country?
My plan for the country is to change politics, not just change Labour, change politics. It doesn't work.
Okay.
The Westminster system doesn't work.
Specifically today, you're announcing, or you're calling, for a cut in business rates.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good example of what I've said in this campaign about a fairer taxation system. And it goes back to the point I made a moment ago about the Westminster system being too close to the big vested interests in this country. So you could put into that the big players in terms of online trading. So if you look at the business rates that they pay, it's about 0.3% of turnover typically, and I'm talking about the biggest players, and we know who they are. You take a pub like this, where we are now in Oral, they could pay 2% more of their turnover. So there's not fairness there in terms of land and property taxation. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying today is we would rebalance things. We would ensure that all pubs in a constituency like this would have a 20% cut in their business rates, typically worth about £5,000 a year. And that would just give them a bit of breathing space to survive, because they're feeling close to the edge right now. High street businesses, that would mean taking them out of business rates altogether.
You spent time with the landlord, Ian, today, as have I. He said pubs, cafes, hospitality generally, actually they'd rather have a 10% VAT cut. That's the issue.
I'm sure.
Not this business rate relief you're suggesting.
I'm sure they would, and I know about that campaign, and actually in the past I've supported that campaign. As Mayor of Greater Manchester, I've been really clear that these businesses should be given priority treatment because they bring people together, because they make high streets feel safer.
And there's already,
because they
as
keep
you
people
know, there's
visiting
already,
after
there's
5
already
p.m.
substantial business rates relief for small businesses from the government. You've also said today, and it's really strong criticism of the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, Labour have got it wrong on small businesses.
Well, they need to listen more.
Quote. So are you promising to reverse the national insurance rise for employers? When it comes to small businesses.
I'm not in a position to make commitments about reversing the manifesto. I have said that I thought the weight of the burden on employers' national insurance wasn't the right decision. However, it was the decision. There is more that needs to be done to listen to the voice of small business. And as I've gone around this constituency, I'm hearing it a lot.
Okay.
People just feel they are at the kind of limits of what they can do.
So they're it sounds like you would be open to that, were you, to end up in a position of power?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that, because I've been on the record as saying that before. This thing I'm announcing today isn't the be-all and end-all.
Sure.
But it is about giving businesses breathing space so that they can survive, and then we can look at what more can be done.
Well, he just sounds incredibly flaky to me there. He doesn't really want to talk about the major. What's your plan? It's a sort of great long gap. He hasn't really, it seems, got a plan. His only plan is to reduce business rates. Well, as Victoria Derbyshire points out, for marginal business, the business rates are already being reduced. He doesn't seem to have any kind of understanding of the macroeconomics, Martin, really, at all.
Well, it's not that he doesn't understand it, he's just not answering the question because he doesn't want to answer it. Because if he answers it at this stage of the game, he's then going to be they're going to hold his feet to the fire and say, "Well, you said so and so and so."
Well, it might actually spark a debate. It might spark a debate amongst the other candidates about the cost of living crisis, what's behind it, and what to do. That's surely a good thing.
Yeah, but what you can see what he's doing there. He's trying to focus it down on his strengths in terms of winning the election, which is a local boy, and he's talking like a local boy about local stuff.
Yeah, but it's boring. The local people. Yes, well, are the voters going to be impressed? I think not. If you look at the latest poll from 2 weeks ago, from 26th of May, they're showing Labour down 2%, Reform up 2%.
This is national polls, presumably.
No, it's just for Makerfield. All right. It's a Makerfield prediction poll. For Restore Britain, they're up 2%. The Lib Dems are down 1%, the Greens are down 1%, the Conservatives are down 1%.
But when you say they're down or up, you've not said what the actual percentage is.
Well, I know, I'm going to do it in a second, Martin. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is where it's moving to me. The final result of all of that is that Labour are still top at 38%, just about. Reform are 35%, Restore Britain are 19%. I mean, it's fascinating to me to see the way that together Reform and Restore are way ahead of Labour. So maybe one of those candidates is just going to step down at some point and say, look, just vote for the other one. And that will really nobble Burnham. Anyway, he's not, I think, doing himself any favours with this tiptoeing around the questions. He needs to show some strong leadership. I think this is what has been the problem with Starmer, is he's been considered by commentators around the world and this UK incredibly flaky.
Well, I mean, I'm not Andy Burnham, so I'm not going to try and second-guess what his strategy is. I haven't the faintest idea. I think what he's trying to do here is he's trying to just get what he needs to do done without giving too many hostages to fortune. Because obviously, being Prime Minister is a huge, huge role, and there's plenty of things.
Yeah,
that
but he doesn't sound really like he's made for the role. He sounds like he's maybe a bit of a gopher rather than a leader.
Well, I think what he's doing is this is what makes this by-election so interesting and important, is there's so many things at stake. So many different things are going on at once. And don't forget, you say that Labour's on 38, but if you add the Greens and the Liberal Democrats to them, then they probably outrun the right. What happens mostly in most other European countries is that the left and the right are pretty evenly balanced.
No, they don't, actually. No, the Lib Dems and the Greens together is only 5%, which brings Labour up to 42%, whereas Reform added to Restore Britain is 54%.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because what could easily happen here is Burnham wins, but a majority of people voted against him.
Yeah.
That's why the system is wrong. It's a stupid system. That's why we need proportional representation, and that's what I would like Andy Burnham to be talking about. We're talking about changing politics. That's the first thing to talk about. But he's being told not to mention that too much, blah, blah. We talked about it the other week. That's the real killer. What are you going to do differently? That's what we're going to do. If I was him, that's what I'd do. But I'm not him. And of course he is, as you say, a centrist politician. He wants to try and get...
What's his views on Israel? For me, many, many politicians, I see this as a bit of a litmus test. If you're prepared to speak out against genocide, then you'll get my vote, maybe.
Yes, and what he said is that Israel is all very wrong, but I don't know if it's a genocide. So he's saying stuff like that. Whereas good old Rupert and good old Nigel are quite clear that they support Israel. They're in favour of genocide. And of course, anybody who votes for them, we are able to say, you're all in favour of genocide, so you are racist. And they say, no, we're not. Yes, you are. You support genocide.
If you had, the dry... If you were the... Say, if you were Andy Burnham, Martin, right, what would you be advising to fix the cost of living crisis? What's the main thing to do?
Well, we need to make peace with Russia and reopen the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and then get loads of Chinese investment in. But of course, to do that, we're going to have to fight with the Americans and the Israelis. Now, who's going to say that in a by-election? The answer is nobody. That's way outside the Overton window. I can say that because I'm just sitting here. But of course, but this is what will happen. But you can't frighten the horses. If you go out and there and tell everybody, we're actually going to have to go to war with Israel like we went to war with Serbia, they won't want to hear it. But we will, of course.
Somebody who's weighed in, and I'm sorry for not playing this last week, it's actually from last week, I actually delight to hear a bit from David Dimbleby, because I'm so sick of seeing this woman, Fiona Bruce, on BBC's Question Time, who doesn't seem to know anything at all. She's kind of nice and friendly to everyone. She asks some sort of vague questions, but she just doesn't have the authority to lead the programme and to chair the discussions and the debates, because she's knowledgeable about which antique will look nice on her mantelpiece, but she doesn't got a clue about British politics and history. She's got people whispering in her ears. The producer will tell her to say this and tell her to say that, but Dimbleby did have the knowledge, and he was interviewed by Bloomberg, who asked him about can Britain's politics cope. So here is Dimbleby giving his verdict on Starmer.
I'd say change him. I think you've got a dud there. I mean, a nice man and no doubt very intelligent man, but a man so overcautious and so seen publicly, I don't know what he is privately, but seen publicly somebody who decides something and then once he gets a bit of opposition turns back. Unlike Thatcher, unlike Blair, who are kind of bold statement politicians, in times of crisis you need that. At the moment the Labour Party is in complete disarray about what it really wants.
So if it is Andy Burnham who comes to Parliament and then is in a position to challenge the Prime Minister, do you think he would be different in substance, or is it the case that he'd be a better communicator, and that is crucial in our age?
I think he'd be a far better communicator. I don't know what his views are. I mean, I've had him on programmes often and have never quite been able to work out what he stands for, to tell the truth. I think it comes and goes a bit. I mean, you know, we've now got this thing that he wants to go back into the EU. Oh, no, I don't, actually. No, I don't want to go back into the EU. No, but obviously he has to say that, because if he goes, I mean, he's not going to win the Labour Party over. He's not going to win the country over if he says it's time to go back into the EU.
Well, he's probably not going to win election in that particular area.
Yeah, that area, I mean, which was a reform area. So how would he be different? I think he has on his side the kind of political patina of energy, youth, enthusiasm, and the so-called success of Manchester, which is, compared to the UK as a whole, tiny microcosm, but nevertheless generally seen to be successful, that they brought in, they got industry to come to Manchester. Manchester was revived under Burnham's mayoralty. And we keep on being told he was very good with the buses. So, you know, those sound small things, but they show a kind of willingness to change. So I mean, who knows?
Andy Burnham's people have told Bloomberg that he would not change the current fiscal rules, which essentially limit borrowing, which leads to the question of how differently he may or may not govern. Would he be a better communicator but a prime minister with a similar policy agenda? Which leads me to wonder, is there something more fundamental to do with the country underway? And you've seen, you know, different governments over a long period of time, in that, are we as a country in favour of, we want good public services, but we don't really want to pay the levels of taxation that make them possible?
Well, we're pretty well taxed, aren't we? We're fairly highly taxed. We're up with the European averages. I think we're in a position of stagnation on government borrowing, on taxation, and on GDP growth. I mean, there's been, since Brexit, what is it, fall on prospective growth of 8%. So people are genuinely feeling hard pressed, hard done by. They're not able to take their holidays. Money doesn't go round as well as it did. And that's really oppressive, because it's a trap. Because the theory of successful social democracy is amelioration all the time. That's the point of it. A society goes richer because of the energy, inventiveness, enthusiasm, and commitment that it has to its own prosperity. So it produces better educated people, it produces more intelligent solutions to problems. And we've had, of course, the problem of going from a heavily industrialized society to a service industry society, which is difficult. But this position of falling back, so you get these terrible stories of you know, young people unemployed in perpetuity, and then coming forward with supposed mental health problems and then being put on drugs and all that. We're in a dire state. I'm not pretending we're not in a dire state. I think we are.
So there's Dimbleby. You were giving his analysis. Of course, he thinks that taxes are already rather high. But anyway, so at least he's giving us an honest view about the incompetence of Starmer. And I think most people would understand that he's wrong on all the main issues, whether it's to do with reversing Brexit, having a war with Russia, etc. And also, of course, on Palestine. It doesn't seem as if there is any connection between Starmer and what the people actually want.
Well, that's why Labour Party members like me and Andy Burnham are thinking of replacing him. Because he's, you know, once you've got to the point where people regard you as a joke and laugh behind your back, there's not a lot you can do about it. And he's reached that point. I think it's very unfair. Dimbleby himself saying this is unfair. In actual fact, he's a boring plodder and he can't think outside the box. Now, of course, that's going to be difficult for anybody being a prime minister, because it's not just a question of sorting out our own business. We're now, as you said at the beginning of the show, in week 14, is it World War III? Now, what do we really need? We need Farage pretending to be Winston Churchill, or do we need somebody who can actually unite the country? And I think Burnham, if he can get into the position, he will then be forced to do things which he doesn't even want to discuss at the moment. That's what would be the best result from my point of view.
Well, I also spoke this week to try and get a sane voice to Chris Williamson, who's a deputy leader of the Galloway's Workers Party and a former Labour MP, and he was an MP for Derby and also the leader of Derby City Council, to ask him what he makes of Andy Burnham, particularly also about this idea of migration and how this is playing out.
I don't think it's around, you know, using cheap migrant labour would be the solution. Far from it, in fact. I mean, what we need is an uplift in people's wages and salaries. Yeah, I mean, Danby Pottery has been around, I think, 217 years. There's going to be 600 jobs in the, you know, in the sort of ceramics industry. I mean, when you think back in the heyday, you know, there was 80,000 people in the potteries alone, you know, around Stoke-on-Trent. I mean, it's thousands, tens of thousands of those jobs that have gone. It's not that the products are still needed. They are. But it's just that as a result of this kind of globalized neoliberal agenda that's been embraced by all of the major political parties, the corporations have seen that they can make more money by offshoring their operations to other countries. And that's left working class communities in the situation now where millions are in poverty and millions more are in precarious employment. I mean, nothing has come in really to replace the previously, you know, secure jobs that we enjoyed. But certainly, you know, one of the major problems that, you know, Denby, for example, has encountered is the very high energy costs. And of course, what's driving that? Well, I mean, you know, it's Britain's support for NATO's proxy war in Ukraine. I mean, what we should be doing is using our good officers as the country to actually bring about peace. I mean, the war actually could have been avoided. I mean, Russia put forward a peace and security draft peace and security treaty in 2021, at the end of 2021, which all it was saying was, look, NATO should stop expanding and Ukraine should be a neutral country. And that was just thrown out, I mean, and completely discarded. I mean, NATO was pushing for a war. I mean, there are articles in the Atlantic Council. I remember seeing one where the headline was the strategic case for risking war with Russia. Well, I mean, it's been an absolute catastrophe in terms of human life and suffering for the Ukrainian people, and also on many of the Russians who've lost their lives and been injured as well, fighting this war. But in terms of the implications for us in the United Kingdom and across the West, you know, with higher energy bills and so on, and that's obviously had an impact on ordinary domestic consumers. The household bills are much more costly than they would otherwise have been, because no longer are we able to access cheap Russian oil, because the Nord Stream pipeline was blown up, but obviously
gas in that case, we've also seen BP and Shell with absolutely colossal, massive record profits.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, these people are making a killing out of this system, and that's why they move heaven and earth to demonize and destabilize any serious political threat to the established status quo. And unfortunately, we've got a Labour Party now which is committed to retaining that status quo. And if Andy Burnham sticks to Rachel Reeves's fiscal rule, then he's going to do exactly the same thing.
Could you say something about what those fiscal rules are and what may be after that, what they should be?
Well, I mean, there's three things really to it. I mean, they say that according to Rachel Reeves' fiscal rule, they want to ensure that spending is matched by taxation, that government's financial liabilities as a percentage of GDP should be falling after 3 years. And it also includes a cap on certain social security benefits. But what we actually need as a country is a huge fiscal stimulus, because clearly the private sector, with this reliance upon the market, isn't serving the interests of ordinary people in this country. And we issue our own currency so we can never run out of money. And what the government's focus should be on is actually identifying and building real resources in the economy, you know, training up workers, identifying, natural resources, etc., investing in, for example, agriculture to make us self-reliant as we possibly can be. You know, we need to be, build a resilient economy. Look, we're seeing, aren't we, these huge international crises. I've mentioned NATO's proxy war in Ukraine. We've also seen, Israel-US attack on Iran, and that's also having significant implications in terms of, the cost of living crisis. We shouldn't be participating in that sort of thing, and we should be using our efforts as a country to, to stop those sorts of crises from occurring. But often these things are out of our hands. I mean, we didn't participate directly, although we did, I think, on the periphery assist with the situation in Iran and so on. But when these crises occur, we are left very, very vulnerable, very exposed. And, we therefore, it seems to me, need to be doing more to make our economy more resilient and make households more resilient. I mean, one of the things that we could be doing, just one example, is the government could, as part of this big fiscal stimulus, be insulating everybody's home and business in the country. That would, at a stroke, eliminate fuel poverty in this country. There are millions of people in this country who are struggling to pay their to pay for their household energy bills. And, there literally is a question often of eating or heating. I mean, I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I mean, what a state to be in when we are the fifth biggest economy in the world. Nobody should be in poverty. Nobody should be struggling in this country. We shouldn't have a housing crisis. Everybody should have a secure job and a secure retirement. We could have it with political will. It's just the political will that's lacking, because the political class in this country serve, the corporate neoliberal sector. And, that's just the way of the world at the moment. And, we need to try and, I think, raise people's consciousness about what the reality of what's happening and raise people's expectations. A good society is within reach. We could actually deliver that. But we just need the politicians to be put in place to make it happen.
Yeah, so I think the question is a couple of questions. Why here? Why is the involvement with foreign wars? And why are there no politicians around who are prepared to do the things that Chris suggests, a fiscal stimulus of some sort?
Well, that's exactly what Jeremy Corbyn was proposing. And of course, he then got monstered in the way that he was monstered. And the same thing happened to Chris Williamson.
So what do certain parts of the political class have to gain by impoverishing the country?
They can make a lot of money out of impoverishing the country. That is basically what Thatcherism and Reaganism and their full has been all about. They've used the existing, the resources that have been built up by generations of British people. The privatisation of those resources at less than their real value has just been theft. And of course, the people who've done that have done very well out of it. So the fact that the economy eventually ends up going down the drain, it's not that important to them because they've made loads of money. That's the problem, isn't it?
And they're having a bit of a beggar thy neighbour attitude, where they're saying, well, why should these people around here have a decent life? Why have we worked so hard to get all our money? We actually much prefer to see them grovelling in the dirt.
Well, if you read your Charles Dickens, you will see that that was the attitude back in the 19th century. And of course, Gore Vidal, who is a sort of, he ran for president, I think, once, he said, well, the thing about the US is poverty has got to be there. It's got to be visible and it's got to be seen to be punished. Otherwise, wealthy people can't enjoy their wealth. And that is the attitude in the US. They want people to be poor and they want to look down on them.
Well, it sounds like here too.
Well, indeed. As I say, read your Charles Dickens. It's all in there. Those attitudes are quite old. poor people deserve to be poor. Not me, though. I'm obviously... God loves me. That's why I've got two cars.
Is it Schadenfreude, I think it's called?
That's German.
This is the same sentiment, isn't it? Enjoying see people suffer.
Well, Schadenfreude is enjoying, you know, tall poppies cut down. This is more to do with, wanting, the poor should be punished. I mean, one of the people, they do social attitude surveys, and a lot of people who voted Conservative vote Conservative because they don't want the poor to be punished. That's what they want. And it's not just that they want their own wealth and they want to have their life.
Is this a way of kind of deflecting guilt from unearned gains?
That's right, isn't it? The psychological thing is exactly that.
Yeah.
They know very well that in actual fact, they don't deserve the money they've got. So they've got to look down on other people. That doesn't mean all of them. But I mean, this attitude towards wealth was, less common than it's become. Yeah. I mean, we used to be a much more solidaristic society when I was growing up. It just was. People did not have the kind of attitudes that have subsequently become very, very normal. Why should I help other people?
Okay, and the other...
After the Second World War, there was a general attitude, well, we do need to actually muck in together,
don't we? The other thing, Martin, really just blows my mind in a way there. Just one tiny phrase Chris used was this, the name of this the Atlantic Council report, the strategic case for risking war with Russia. Who the hell are the Atlantic Council?
Well, anybody's got their AI can look them up. They're funded by the American government and the corporations in order to keep, Britain and the US on the same page so that we do what they want and we all go to war with Russia or with Iran on behalf of Israel. That's what we've got to do. So we can't discuss any of that. Yeah. And of course, if we can't discuss any of that, we can't really discuss the economy. This is the problem for Rachel Reeves. It's not a question of what technical things should you do with the economy. If we're going to have World War III with Iran, it's all that stuff goes in the waste paper basket anyway. We'll have to talk about something else, won't we?
So the Atlantic Council clearly are some of the major... I mean, do you know much about who they are? They're a very right-wing think tank.
Well, I have come across them. I mean, there's the Henry Jackson Society.
He also,
Council for Foreign Relations. There's all these groups out there.
They are particularly crazy, the Atlantic Council, and they are linked apparently to something called the RAND Corporation.
Yes, which is very much the Pentagon's think tank. So they're the ones who are telling us we need to risk a war with Russia.
They're simply saying, well, we are the Pentagon, we are the military, we want to drum up a case for more money being spent of people's taxes on the military.
Well, they're just about...
Isn't that what they're up to?
That's right. Well, they're just massive... Trump's just said they're going to massively increase the Pentagon's budget.
What about our very own Defence Secretary and Armed Forces Ministry resigned? Now, could obviously...
Yes, we need to spend more money on military, Tony.
Well, no.
Of course we do.
No, they're just looking at Starmer collapsing and saying, well, if we resign now, we stand a good chance, and we have a bit of a pop at Starmer, we stand a good chance of being picked up by Burnham to do that same role in the future. In fact, you might well see more Cabinet Ministers doing this.
Well, it'll be interesting to see which way Burnham jumps. Everybody across the spectrum in the Overton window, the mainstream bit that we're all supposed to talk about on the mainstream
media.
Don't
you think that the Atlantic Council and people like this are holding Burnham's feet to the fire?
Yes.
Saying, we will support you, but only if X,
That's
Y,
right.
and Z.
So in other words, what's happening with Burnham now as he tries to claw his way up the greasy pole is various people are squeezing his testicles and twisting his arm and saying, you can't say that. Now, what he could do is say, well, I'm going to say that. He could do a Jeremy Corbyn.
Is he the type?
No, he isn't. What he's trying to do is crab-like, do what he wants to do without giving too many hostages to fortune. I can see what he's doing, but of course, if he was to come out and say, look, we need to leave NATO, we need to raise taxes on people like Nigel Farage, and we need to stop going to war with Iran.
We're hearing from Chris Williamson the sort of things that.
No, that's right. But Chris Williamson isn't an MP anymore.
Well, I mean, he's probably looking at people like Liz Truss and saying, well, she decided she was going to think a bit outside the box, and look what happened to her.
Well, exactly. I mean, she was falling out of the box in the wrong direction, so the people in the box actually knew more than she did. But that's another problem. It is very difficult to be a politician in a situation where corporations run everything and the Pentagon runs the corporations.
Have you ever seen a very British coup, that film?
Yeah.
Where the Prime Minister decides he's going to resign because there's so many pressures on him from all finance from the city, royalty, etc., the military. And so it's a bit like, it's kind of modelled on Wilson and his resignation. Chris Mullin, I think, was the author. It's a fantastic film and a fantastic book. It came out in the 1980s, I think, or maybe early 90s, and the Prime Minister goes onto TV to give his resignation. They all think, oh great, we're going to get rid of him now. But as he goes onto TV live, he starts to say, there's this cabal been operating behind the scenes, right? I'm not going to resign. What we're going to do is we're going to fix the country like this and this and this, and we're going to arrest any of those people who have been trying to undermine democracy and undermine. And there's a wonderful, it cuts to the gallery up in the TV studio where was an executive producer or editor or something says, okay, cut the feed. And then there's a battle going on within the TV station over whether they're going to cut him off or not. No, they let him carry on, you know. So, but it's a terrific, it's Chris Mullin's book. Very, very good. If you've not come across that, have a good, because this is the sort of situation that people like Burnham are put into, where they have an idea about what they'd like to do, but they're being told, no, you can't do that.
Yes. So you've then got to decide, are you going to go front head to head with them? Or you've got to actually pretend to not go head to head with them, so you can somehow, you know,
well, you might even end up like Robin Cook.
Well, that's right, or John F. Kennedy.
Anyway, back to the sort of practical things that could and should happen with a decent new Labour government. This idea of Rachel Reeves, so she's got these three fiscal rules that she's trying to keep to. One is spending must equal taxation.
Well, no, over the long term. She's not got to do it in the short term, but it's, you know, over 3 years she's got to be bringing it down and all the rest of it.
So the percentage of GDP, the debt to GDP, must be falling after 3 years.
Yes.
So those two combined. So that's really number two is part of number one. So, you know, does this make sense to make sure spending and taxation are equal?
Not necessarily. Of course, anybody who's read The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money by J.M. Keynes, which came out in 1936, knows that you don't have to balance the books. But what's happened since 1980 is that everybody presumes that the books have got to be balanced, and you've got to pretend to balance them, even if you're not balancing them.
They've got this argument against printing money, saying, oh, it's going to cause inflation. Well, not necessarily.
It's not necessarily the case, no, because, of course, if you've got unemployed people and unemployed resources, if you spend money, all that happens is those people are then put to work, which is, no doubt, Chris Williamson's argument. There is a problem with leakage, because if you spend the money it's actually spent on imports, that doesn't have much of an effect in your own country. So you probably need to work with other countries, and everybody has to have a fiscal stimulus at the same time. That's what should happen when we've got democracies in various countries all working together to make sure that we can get control. It's very difficult to do this in one country like Britain, which is a small country. Russia can do it, but then Russia has got it's a massive country, and they've got every resource you can think of, and they don't need any imports.
And then finally, the three main points that Rachel Reeves has said she's going to do, her little rules, is that she's going to introduce a cap on Social Security.
Yes, the whole thing to keep the bond market happy and the money people is we've got to cut down the spending on welfare. Now, in actual fact, welfare spending is actually quite positive to the economy. If you give money to poor people, if they're disabled or if they're just out of work, whatever it is, they will spend that money. Of course they will. They don't save it, they spend it. And in actual fact, the welfare system is in fact positive for the economy, especially in times where the economy's going down as it is now. We're probably going to have unemployment rising very shortly. And of course, the fact that these people get benefits means that the economy doesn't go down and down and down. Countries that don't have unemployment benefits and welfare spending, you know, think of countries in Africa, for example, as the economy goes down, it can carry on going down because there's nothing to stop it. The thing about having a welfare system, as we discovered from the 1930s onwards, it's like having an airbag in your car. The car may crash, but you're not going to go through the windscreen because the airbag will protect you. So all of this is all the kind of talk that the Economist and the Financial Times wants to hear from her. And she's more interested in keeping them happy than she is in keeping us happy. Because in actual fact, that's who the Chancellor of the Exchequer works for.
Why don't the London news media hold her feet to the fire on that? She's supposed to be working for us, not them.
Yeah, but the London Rouge media and the Financial Times and the Economist I just mentioned, they're all very highly paid, a lot of them privately educated, and they don't want to pay more taxes. So in actual fact, it's in their interests to pay their school fees.
A lot of the businesses that own these media corporations of various sorts, they're actually based in tax havens of various sorts, and they hardly pay any tax. So they're basically tax dodgers.
Yes, they are. And actually, in fact, because people like Richard Murphy, the Tax Justice Network, have been saying we should be getting money out of these people. And there is loads of things we could do to get money out of them, but we don't do it. What has happened over time, and it certainly wasn't the case at the end of the Second World War or into the Korean War, what has happened over time is that wealthy classes have just become completely parasitic. A lot of what goes on in the City of London produces absolutely
particularly through infrastructure. So stuff that we need to have in China, it's cheap as chips. Over here, it's getting more and more and more expensive. I'm talking about things like energy, housing.
That's right. And if you can make more money buying shares in that, why have a startup business in doing something
this
new?
This is why all that money is going into places like housing, etc., building houses and energy markets, is because it's easy money.
It's easy money. Of course, the difficult money is actually producing new stuff.
That money will stay there even if the rest of the economy and manufacturing starts to collapse.
That's right.
Because people need this stuff.
Yes, and in actual fact, if it was owned by the government, that then becomes another source of support for the general population. You can just reduce prices if you want to. Cover your costs, because if you're a nationalised industry, all you've really got to do is cover your costs. So you could cut the actual bills for ordinary people right to the as low as they could possibly get.
I'll put the full version of the interview with Chris Williamson up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where we talk about the migrant crisis, the riots in Belfast, as well as all the prospects for Andy Burnham and why he thinks that Burnham is just going to be the final clip we're going to hear is where I asked him about, so are you saying that actually, yes, Burnham might well win, but it's hardly going to be any change at all?
Well, I think there'll be some tinkering, but it needs more than tinkering. I think maybe, Andy's instincts on the domestic agenda are probably genuine. I'd like to think they were. I mean, I like Andy, I know Andy from when I was an MP previously, and he seems like a decent sort of guy. It's just his politics is a bit where it ought to be, I think. And I think he will genuinely want to try and, certainly on the domestic front anyway, say his foreign policy is another question. But on the domestic front, I think he genuinely would want to try and do things a bit differently. But he won't be able to do that, as I keep saying, if he sticks to the fiscal rules and if he's frightened to death of the bond market. We need a bold ambition, really a bit like, what we did in 1945. He needs to rediscover that spirit of 1945. I mean, and that was a radical government too. I think could have done more, but, they did a pretty good job.
Well, they also knew how to discipline the Bank of England. And it's funny you mention that, because I was just walking along some of the coastline here around the Bristol Channel, and I saw 1947 implanted into all of the new flood defences that had been built. And this is supposedly in a country that had been smashed to pieces, was trying to pick itself up after World War II with bomb sites all over the place. So if they can do it then, surely we can do it now.
Of course we can. I mean, it's just about political will, and there was a real determination then, I think, to not go back to the circumstances that the people like my mum and dad's generation had to endure. And of course, the other thing was that there were millions of people being demobilized from the military who had been politicized and weren't going to go back to the 1930s. And there was a very real fear, I think, of a revolution. There's all these millions of people being demobbed who knew about military discipline, knew how to use a weapon. And don't forget, the Russian Revolution, wasn't that long before that. I mean, 20 years or so before the end of the Second World War. So I think there's a real fear that unless there were these social reforms, it could very well have been a revolution in this country. But even that Labour government, though, as I've said, I think it could have done more on the domestic front, but it didn't do a bad job. And, we set in train that post-war consensus. His foreign policy, though, was pretty it's got to be said. So I mean, it's a bit like, with Andy Burnham, really, as I say, his foreign policy, is not good at all. But people can change. I mean, I hope you will reflect on that. He said he's changed from his period as previous minister and so on. I think he's recognised now that if he's true of what he's saying about, we've been on the wrong path for 40 years. Of course, he was part of keeping the country on that path when he was in in the new Labour.
Well, it's warm words, so let's just see. I mean, people do say this sometimes, when especially when they've got their eye on the main chance. Anyway, Chris Williamson, can you just tell us whereabouts people can find and follow you online?
Yeah, I mean, follow me on social media. I'm at Darby Chris W on X, or formerly Twitter, and I'm also on Facebook under my name, Chris Williamson.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
All the best. Cheers.
So there's former MP Chris Williamson. It seems to be very difficult to find people who are just so clear on the left about the way forward, particularly when it comes to the national finances. We're constantly being told there's not enough money, there's not enough money, and everyone can see so much is going to Zelensky, Ukraine, and this sort of thing. So there clearly is money for certain things, and that's how our government is operating, and it seems to be almost impossible within the system to break it. That's why what Chris is saying there and showing the way is quite important, actually.
It is, and I think that was a fairly fair assessment of Andy Burnham, I thought.
Yeah.
But Andy Burnham cannot be what people like Chris Williamson and me would like him to be entirely, and he's not, you know, he's trying to work within the setup that we've already got. Now, I don't think it's going to work. I think the crisis is so great that ultimately we're going to have more radical policies. But at the moment, people still haven't taken on board how serious the international situation is, and that they're going to have to change their attitude to lots of things. Because, you know, people get used to doing what they're doing. And of course, you know, capitalism is very, very good at keeping everybody busy talking about all sorts of... Are we going to be covering the World Cup this week, Tony? Who do you think is going to win?
So Andy Burnham talks about public control, but he doesn't talk about public ownership.
That's
so he's talking about
policy, isn't it?
Strong regulation, but all you can do is sort of prod and push, and the companies that are actually owning the infrastructure would just say, no, don't fancy that.
That's right. Well, that's the issue, isn't it?
And they hire corporate lawyers to tell the government where to go.
Yes. And, of course, Jeremy Corbyn was much more forthright. And, of course, he ended up being monstered in the way that we all know. So Burnham isn't from that wing of the party. He's soft left. He wants to tinker. He wants to be more caring and all the rest of it.
Would you call him a wet?
Well, I mean, these are
the old days, they used to talk about the Tory wets, didn't they?
Yeah, the Tory wets. Well, I mean, frankly, somebody like Burnham would probably be a Tory wet. Yeah, the Labour Party used to put forward radical views. Yeah, Tony Benn and all the rest of it. Burnham is not like that. And, of course, people like Burnham take the view that it's all very well for radicals like myself and Chris Williamson and Tony Benn, who's dead now, to demand, you know, everything. But in actual fact, the real world means that most people won't want that and they won't understand it. And even if we try and do it, they'll try and stop us. So we've got to try and find a way to live with the situation. I don't agree with it, but you can see why people might say that. Yeah, it's a safety first, let's not rock the boat too much approach. And, you know, a lot of people who don't follow it very deeply or don't understand it very deeply, that makes sense to them, because they don't really understand much about economics. I'll be honest with you, most people don't. So that, you know, if you try and explain what we really need to do is nationalise it all.
But people
can
understand this whole idea of, well, there's all the money's going to Zelensky.
Well, I mean, they can understand that we've got a whole base in Akrotiri in Cyprus, which costs billions, and another base in Diego Garcia, which costs billions.
And apparently no submarines.
Well, there you are.
I don't know if you saw that. Anyway, look, how the other half live, I think it's, let's just, because having had Chris Williamson, I think it's useful to look at the establishment, and what better person to, he's one of my favourite ever MPs, actually. His name's Norman Baker. He was a Lib Dem MP for Lewis, and he's now taken it in his retirement. He actually wrote the book on the strange death of Dr. David Kelly, and Norman is often to be seen on social media going around the country admiring and driving his very own Triumph Herald with all these old cars. He's going into that nostalgia thing, which I rather like. I was joking during the week, if he wants to have from a standing start in my Mini Cooper from 1968, I will very happy to have a race with his Triumph Herald Vitesse, or whatever it was he's got. But anyway, the point is, let's have a listen to him now talking about the establishment, because it's a completely different world. Martin, we've heard recently that the Duchy of Cornwall, this is the estate controlled by Prince William, is now considering selling off chunks of land for housing. Now, traditionally, this has not been, they've not been doing this sort of thing. They've done little developments here and there. But this is obviously quite a valuable asset, and William has decided it's time to make some money from it.
Well, I think he'll be saying that but we can see there's a housing crisis and we want to do our bit. Of course, building more houses isn't really the issue. We've got plenty of houses. It's just wealthy people won't share them. What could happen, of course, is that local authorities, if they had the authority, could buy up private houses as they come onto the market and turn them into council houses.
Couldn't they?
Have to build a new one.
What an excellent idea. But no, this is not what they're going to do. They're going to do this marvellous piece of magic called planning permission, where a piece of land, which is going to cost you maybe about £2,000 an acre overnight, because you've got planning permission on it, Prince William, you're going to be able to get that land for, especially since you're able to appoint the people who make the decisions about planning in the planning inspectorate, etc. You're going to manage to make an absolute fortune out of this. This is an asset. Of course, he's just treating it like a business. Oh, this is, let's just make some money from it. And here's Norman Baker discussing the, he calls it actually the truth about the Duchy of Cornwall's estate.
The one I'm going to pick out here from my book on page 71 is about Plymouth Devonport, because there the Duchy of Cornwall, William, charges the Navy £10,000 a year just to be able to access its own oil depot to refuel its warships. And that's where Britain's Trident nuclear submarines are. And, of course, William is Commodore-in-Chief of the Submarine Service. So what you're seeing is, rather than helping the Submarine Service, he's actually ripping them off and making sure they pay money. Just charging the MOD for mooring boats at the Royal Naval College at Dartmouth, which is where he trained as a naval cadet. So not much in terms of recompense for them from that particular training exercise they carried out. But we saw, of course, that you mentioned Dartmoor. Dartmoor is a classic example, because what Dartmoor is a deal over 21 years, I think it is, where there's a requirement for the Ministry of Justice to pay a very large rent just because a prison happens to be on Duchy soil. But beyond that, of course, the prison is empty. There's nobody in there because there's a radon gas issue. And also, as part of the agreement signed, the Duchy of Cornwall has required the Ministry of Justice to upgrade the prison. So they're spending money, hundreds of thousands of pounds, on upgrading a prison with nobody in it. Because that's part of the deal. I mean, this is absurd. They're also charging, perhaps the most egregious example, is that on Dartmoor again, the Duchy of Cornwall is charging the army to practice on Dartmoor. These are people who are fighting for king and country, and you have to pay for the privilege to the Prince of Wales. I mean, really, it's quite extraordinary. And this only came out because of some fantastic investigative journalism by Channel 4 and by, in fact, the Sunday Times, who went through a whole lot of property details to find this all out. Because, as we know, the royal family has largely exempted itself from freedom of information, and they think it would never come out. Well, it has come out, and it's deeply embarrassing. And I think many people across the country who have seen this, that's woken them up and said, you know, this royal family is not beneficial to this country, is not acting in a way that's selfless, it's acting to maximise its profits. And if you just look at what William's done since he came into the Duchy of Cornwall, taking over from his father, let's be quite clear. William is more mercenary about money than even his father is. And his father's pretty mercenary about money, because what he's done is reconstituted the Prince's Council, which runs the Duchy of Cornwall. Who's he brought on? He has brought on people who are investment bankers and property developers. So, you know, you look at the Duchy of Cornwall's annual report, there's a nice picture of the countryside on the front of it. You know, that's nothing to do with what his mindset is. His mindset is about maximising the profit for himself. He takes a very close interest on a weekly basis on what the Duchy of Cornwall board is doing and the Duchy itself is doing. And although he's cut back on the number of royal duties he's been carrying out in public, he's not been cutting back on his investment time at the Duchy of Cornwall. His aim is to maximise the profit for himself from that duchy. And that, I'm afraid, is coming ahead of public duties for William. So, you know, people need to look at that with a hard nose. Also, you need to look at what they're doing with their investment bankers and their property developers. Look at what's happening in Faversham, for example, where they're proposing to build a huge number of houses on grade one agricultural land, contrary to what people locally want, because they want a lot more profit from housing, because the best crop for them is a crop of new housing. And this is following on from what his father did elsewhere in the country. They are big-time property developers, and they do so without having to pay corporation tax or capital gains tax. Look at some of the investments they've made over the years. They bought a warehouse in Milton Keynes because, although the front page of their reports shows some nice green bit of land, they've got some pretty horrible industrial buildings in the Dutch Cornwall portfolio. They bought that warehouse in Milton Keynes for £38 million. They sold it not long after for £61 million, a massive profit of £23 million. Anyone else would pay capital gains tax on that? The Treasury. The Duchy of Cornwall and Prince William and Charles before him doesn't.
And let's just talk about secrecy. So in your book, you mentioned, for example, that William was the first royal, presumably, and I think over a century, who did not declare his wedding gifts. And you also write in the book that he's very secretive about the duchy, even though Charles wasn't. Charles was more open. His grandmother was more open. So William seems, notwithstanding the recent briefing about the £7 million, to have really brought the shutters down and is arguably the most secretive heir in many, many decades. How do you think he gets away with that?
He is the most secretive. Charles wasn't open. He was more open than William, but he wasn't open. And actually, if you look at what was available from the Duchy of Lancaster, the Queen, Elizabeth II, who controlled that, was more open by some distance than Charles was about the Duchy of Cornwall. Duchy of Lancaster archives, for example, are in the National Archives. The Duchy of Cornwall archives are not available to people. They are private, apparently. Everything's private. That's a favourite word of the royals, private. They say they're open to requests for information, but there's a guy called John Kirkhope, who's a fantastic digger for information, Duchy of Cornwall, down in that part of the world. He asked for papers, to see papers from Duchy of Cornwall from 1832, and was told he couldn't see them. They were private. This is 200 years ago. They let nothing out. So how do they get away with it? The same way royals get away with it generally. They're exempt largely from freedom of information. They've managed to secure that over quite some time because the government's intention back in 2001, 2002, when I asked the relevant government minister about this, was that the royal family would be treated in the same way as any other part of the public sector. In other words, the same protections for personal privacy, but also in terms of what they're doing publicly for public duties and public money, they would be open to scrutiny. Well, that's never happened, or it's got worse, because Charles has lobbied, when he was Prince of Wales, lobbied the government to change the rules, and now there's an absolute blanket exemption for Charles and William from freedom of information releases. Secondly, of course, the change to the civil list to sovereign grant has changed the way Parliament looks at these matters, or doesn't look at them anymore. There used to be regular annual debates about the civil list, which, of course, enabled people to raise matters about the Duchy of Cornwall if they wanted to do so. Those debates don't happen anymore. There's been no debate about royal finances in Parliament since 2011. This is extraordinary for a large amount of money. They're also costing us £500 million a year, and we're not discussing it in Parliament. That's extraordinary. So that's happened. Then, of course, in terms of the media, there's been, I'm afraid, a lot of the media hasn't either got the investigative journalism resource which they need to have, or alternatively, they're very happy to receive handouts from the royal family with nice pictures of Prince George when he's 10 or whatever they are, and put them in the papers, and that's royal coverage, and they don't ever look at the serious issues. That's changing a bit now. It's changing, I think, following that Channel 4 documentary. And they are becoming more interested, but they haven't up until now, because the royal family has wanted to bring down the shutters. They wanted to make sure that there's privileged access given to journalists who are favourable to them, and journalists who want to ask difficult questions, by and large, are not treated favourably. And if people pursue matters, then they're subject to legal action from the royals themselves. An example I would give you was that when Charles was out shooting at Sandringham, because, of course, the royal family likes killing animals. They don't like people to know that. They don't publicise it. But they do like that. That's one of their great activities. Prince Andrew, as you well know, was referred to this shooting weekend, famously, on that BBC car crash interview with Emily Maitlis. People thought that was extraordinary, but I mean, it's just normal business for them. But on a shooting weekend, Charles was out there shooting, and he was captured on camera by a member of the public. And he immediately phoned up the police. And the police came along and said, well, the man's on a public footpath. He's entitled to take a picture of you if he wants to take a picture. Quite correct police response. The man was, I think, so incensed he went to the Mail on Sunday to tell him the story. The next thing that happened was Charles's lawyers were threatening the Mail on Sunday with legal action to stop the story being published. Well, good on the Mail on Sunday because he published it. And that's how we know about this story. But, you know, they try and control the news in a way that nobody else is able to do. If you go back to 30, 40 years, when there were royal interviews, for example, with Charles in his early days, he didn't give them very often, but they were genuine interviews. Mm. Now when he gives interviews, they are scripted. They have to agree the questions in advance he's going to be asked. You know, can you imagine agreeing to that if you were a politician? So it's Keir Starmer or Kevin Bennenock said, well, I'm only going to answer these questions. You have to ask these questions. I'll answer those, not other ones you want to ask. That's an impossible situation for a journalist to be in.
Yeah, but journalists, so-called journalists, do it anyway because they don't have a choice. Oh, I've got a major exclusive with King Charles. The only thing is King Charles has chosen all the questions himself. And what, I mean, I'll put the full version of that interview is a podcast of some sort with Norman Baker about the royal finances and about the change into becoming basically a corporation that's for profit rather than just a sort of charitable organisation, the Duchy of Cornwall. And the other thing to say about all that is that the Jimmy Savile, it was actually, wasn't it, that wrote the Royal Public Relations Manual.
Yeah, I mean, the Duchy of Cornwall has never been a charity. It's always been a feudal structure. Yeah, the kind of feudal structure that was smashed in France in the 1790s, but they're still around here. And of course, they don't have such things like that in the United States either.
But actually, they do. They do act on a, what you might just about. I mean, a bit like the National Trust, actually, a kind of charitable basis. In that there are many villages which are owned by the Duchy of Cornwall who have reasonable social rents rather than market rents. So they're not quite up to market rents, although they are moving in that direction.
Well, the thing is that, you know, the feudal landowner can do whatever he likes. If he wants to be kind to you, then he's going to be kind to you.
The feudal landowners tend to like to have their local vassals to be able to at least walk down the street rather than this is, you know, some sort of horrible business operating remotely.
Well, that's when the original, when if you think about the PR of the monarchy going back to the Middle Ages, it's always been that, you know, we are here for your benefit and we want to help people. We're not like those greedy capitalists who will just try to make money.
But the fact is, well, actually, they do. They run basically like housing associations, and many villages are actually parts of feudal estates which are very well run and well maintained homes. Now, I'm not saying they're not making money out of it, but it sounds to me as if the Prince William's estate is now fast becoming a company, basically. It's rather than, as the same way, in fact, as a lot of housing associations are becoming more commercial.
Well, that's right. Do you remember we were covering this the other week about this damaged area in Wigan, which was, you know, had to be cleaned up, and it was owned by the Duchy of Lancaster. Yeah. Now, Norman Baker's very good that he's pursuing all of this, because most people are blissfully unaware of the role of the Crown in land ownership and other things in this country.
Appointment of officials, yeah. Military judges, all this
also,
sort of thing. They have a role in that.
All the land.
And also, of course, what he didn't make, I mean, I'm sure he knows about this, but the reason that Charles, when he was Prince Charles, managed to get the entire royal estate and all the royal parts of the royal family taken out of the Freedom of Information Act was because of these black spider letters. He had a circle of individuals who he saw as his mates, basically, who were told, you're not allowed to tell anyone what I'm thinking, but this is what I'm really thinking. And these, of course, make fascinating reading. So if anyone has got access to any of these black spider letters, I would be very happy to publish them and fight a court case with King Charles over whether we were or not we're allowed to see them.
We didn't know that in actual fact that he was able to see all the Crown was able to see all legislation before it goes through Parliament, and they're allowed to object to anything
This is what the royalists said. We didn't even know that they had this veto power. I mean, I can remember doing this.
We only found out in the last few years.
School. Well, I kind of knew this at school. This royal assent is the king can just say, well, hang on a minute, I'm not signing this one. Make a few changes
But the point about the spider letters, Tony, is that he got access to what was going to go into bills before they became law. He can actually say, take that out. And we're not allowed to know that he had that access. And we only recently found out. In actual fact, there's loads more to uncover about the workings of the monarchy.
So what's the relationship, do you think, between the monarchy and the City of London? These two massively powerful organisations that seem to be the sort of puppeteers in this country, and they sit and laugh and watch as the people in Parliament go through their pantomime.
The City of London and the monarchy didn't get on in the English Civil War. That's a lot of what it was about.
Well, then there was something called the Glorious Revolution, and they got on again.
Yes, that's right. That's what it was all about. And, of course, in Ireland, the land belongs to the Irish people, what used to be Crown
Land. Russia's actual land actually does belong to the Russian people. It's your private property.
Well, it belongs to the government, but then you can have it. But
it's your private property. This is in Kevin Cahill's Who Owns the World.
Yeah.
Russia is one of the only countries on Earth where you actually do physically own the property under your feet. I'm with you on this land nationalisation thing, really, where land is not property, just like, you know, whether it might be a car or a cup or a glass or a bicycle. Land is something that you're holding in trust, and you don't necessarily want to sell it to a corporation. You maybe sell land for a lower price to the people you think are going to look after it. It's not the same. So land and private property don't really go together, do they?
Well, I mean, obviously it depends where you live, is the truth about that. But of course, in countries which did have revolutions, like the French Revolution, for example, the land-owning classes lost their land. That was it. They still carried on being aristocrats, and they carried on whatever, you know, their legal titles to their whatever it is, which are not recognised by the state. But the land was given to the small farmers that owned it. Same thing happened in Ireland. Same thing happened in Nicaragua. This is called land reform. And of course, it's very important. It's very important in China. Yeah. And of course, you know, in theory, you see that the Crown is not a corporation.
What we never hear about in the cost of living, we never hear about. This is what I find so fascinating about the way the mass media works. You will never hear, as I was on this programme with Melvin Bragg years ago, and the bit they edited out was the bit where I said, well, actually, you don't need a job if you've got land. And they edited that out. I just thought this is so sneaky of them. What is the one of the main problems of poverty in this country today is landlessness. The banks like Lloyds have decided that we are going to own as much housing as we possibly can. So the market in housing is only being propped up by the fact that the banks are bidding for it. Otherwise, it would probably be starting to go down.
Well, it is starting to go down, as you know.
Well, the banks aren't running out of money to buy a property.
Well, I mean, not
they
yet.
Just don't want to pay so much.
Yeah. Anyway, all of these things are you know, I mean, the British state is a very old piece of kit. It's like an old boiler, which is just falling apart and just about keeping going. But in actual fact, we need to strip it out and put in some modern central heating. But that's a revolution.
One place we need to do that, I think, is, and I did promise that I'd try and do this, is Andy Roberts and the Fine Print looking at Royal Mail.
All right, so buckle up, because this one is going to make you want to put your fist through a wall, and by the end of it, I'm going to give you something useful to do instead. But first, you need to understand exactly what was done to you, by who, and how they've walked off clean. So in October 2013, the British government sold a 508-year-old national institution, Royal Mail, founded by Henry VIII, who, as we know, had a very relaxed attitude to things that should probably never be gotten rid of. And they sold it so comprehensively badly that on the very first day of trading, the city pocketed £750 million off of the back of it in one single day. The man responsible, Vince Cable, the business secretary, and he was asked directly on camera whether he could have priced it higher. He said, "Well, I could have done, and I could have joined the speculators and spivs, but I'm not interested in doing that." Standing firm against the spivs, while simultaneously the banks advising his government were quietly handing preferential share allocations to their investment arms, which 10 sold within days for millions. The spivs were already at the table. Vince had put the good cutlery out for them. That is this story. A government sold something that belonged to all of us, underpriced it deliberately, handed the discount to city institutions who flipped it within hours, took a £750 million hit on day one, removed a £37.5 billion pension liability, and loaded it onto you at £4 million a day, and then watched the service collapse until a check billionaire bought it in 2025 for roughly the same price, despite JP Morgan valuing it at up to £10 billion in 2013. Oh, and now the first class stamp is at £1.80 instead of the 60p that it was at in 2012. Before the heist, you need to understand what actually got flogged off. Royal Mail is not just a delivery company. It gave the world its first postage stamp back in 1840. The penny black created the principle that one price sends a letter anywhere in the country and has been part of British daily life ever since Henry VIII established it in 1516. When your nan sends a birthday card, she's using a system that predates America. The Universal Service Obligation is to deliver to every address in the UK 6 days a week for the same flat price. It's what makes it different from every courier that's ever left your parcel in a wheelie bin. Every doesn't reach Orkney for the same price as Clapham. Royal Mail has to, by law. That is what was sold. By 2013, it was making about £403 million in operating profit. The pension deficit sorted, courtesy of you, the taxpayer. Parcel volumes were rising on the back of Amazon, and the coalition government thought, yes, you know what? Now is a good time to sell. The 150,000 workers were balloted on whether they wanted their employer privatised. 96% said no. The government looked at that and went, eh, sodger, and proceeded anyway. Now, one imagines the ballot results were delivered by a service that still worked. Now, here's what the government knew before they priced the shares at 330 pence each. JP Morgan had privately valued Royal Mail at up to £10 billion. Citibank, up to £6.5 billion. Deutsche Bank, £5.6 to £6 billion. Barclays, not even advising on the sale, just their equity team doing their actual job, told institutional investors before the float that shares were worth up to £4.20. On day one, shares closed at £4.55. That's a 38% jump, the highest first-day rise ever recorded for a privatised UK company. £750 million in new value in 24 hours. That was your money. Not because the company got better overnight, just because it was priced way too cheaply. Probably deliberately. The IPO was oversubscribed 24 times. 700,000 people applied, each got 227 shares worth £749. Meanwhile, something else was happening that the government went to considerable lengths to keep on the quiet. Before the public got near their allocation, 16 city institutions were handed priority investor allocations, preferential, guaranteed shares at 330p. These were stable, long-term investors who'd given Royal Mail solid ownership. Cable said publicly, the government put it in writing. Within days, in some cases within hours, six of the 16 had sold their entire stake. By January 2014, three quarters had sold, nearly half of their holdings. Capital Group went from 20 million shares to 3 million in a single week. George Soros Fund was out within weeks, and Lansdowne Partners, whose co-founder had donated £700,000 to the Conservative Party, and whose co-head was George Osborne's best man at his wedding, coincidence that, received 18 million shares. When the Bureau of Investigative Journalism finally forced the names out, the government had been blocking FOI requests about the public assets they'd just sold on the grounds of commercial confidentiality, Cable admitted discomfort with the profits being made. Among the 16 priority investors was Lazard Asset Management, the investment arm of Lazard & Company. Lazard & Company was simultaneously the government's own independent advisor on the privatization. Lazard, the advisor, told the government not to raise the price. Lazard, the investor, received 6 million shares, sold within days, and made £8 million profit. Lazard, the advisor, also collected a £1.5 million fee. The committee chair called it Alice in Wonderland. He was probably being polite with that. While everyone argued about share prices, something happened in 2012 that barely made the news and that you are still paying for every single day. The government took over Royal Mail's pension scheme, £28 billion in assets, £37.5 billion in liabilities, a £10 billion deficit. The government absorbed both sides, took the assets into Treasury to reduce debt on paper, and assumed the liabilities. George Osborne called it a windfall. What it actually was, taxpayers funding index-linked pensions for hundreds of thousands of former postal workers indefinitely from public money with no investment fund behind it. Since 2012, that obligation has cost £16.5 billion, roughly £4 million a day. The remaining liability, £28 billion. Economist Neil Record put it plainly. The government promised index-linked pensions, then took the £29 billion sitting in the pension fund and spent it. This was done deliberately to make Royal Mail attractive to investors. The pension albatross was lifted off the company's books and loaded onto yours. And what it would cost was never mentioned on the day Vince Cable told the country they'd done a brilliant deal.
So that's Andy Roberts at Fine Print, really just taking apart this share flotation of a public asset called the Royal Mail. As he says, goes back hundreds of years. The pioneering postal service in the world flogged off for peanuts.
Yeah, and of course it was just after the financial crisis of 2008-2009. And so the Tories were allowed to come to power with Liberal Democrat support, and of course Steve Williams was minister, local MP, was the minister in the government, MP for this area, and of course what they did is they went along with all this Tory twaddle about selling privatisation to balance the books
and student loans.
Yes, and all the rest of it.
This one thing we're going to make sure that we put an end to student loans, but of course they didn't.
No.
And of course, the Lib Dems
in other words, what should have happened in 2008-2009, a radical government should have come to power and said, we're going to regulate the banks and we're going to renationalise everything. That wasn't what happened. They were bailed out. And then, of course, because they were bailed out, we haven't got any money. So now we've got to privatise to cover the fact that we've got a deficit. And, of course, it's just robbery. That's what it is. If we had a proper free market economy, the banking system would just have been allowed to collapse. And that means that all wealthy people lose all their money in the system. That's what the capitalist textbook says. But if they're bailed out when they get into trouble, they actually make more money. So they've been bailed out and they get the chance to get all this privatisation in their pockets at the same time.
Okay,
by the wealthy classes.
Okay, they're
robbers.
Before the break, we've got to have a bit more from Andy Roberts about British Rail next week, or the next couple of weeks. Before the break, Palestine Action activists will be sentenced as terrorists, court confirms today. This is news just out. There's actually quite a big demonstration in central London today and possibly in other parts of the country too. For Palestine Action activists who damaged Israeli military assets, including drones, will be sentenced for an act of terrorism, a judge has ruled. Charlotte Head, 29, Samuel Corner, 23, Leona Camillo, 30, and Fatima Rajwani, 21, were found guilty of criminal damage in May after breaking into a factory in Filton near Bristol, owned by Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit, in 2024. Corner was also convicted of grievous bodily harm without intent. Justice Jeremy Johnson, that's the guy, Justice Jeremy Johnson told the Woolwich Crown Court that he found the defendants were well aware of the aims and strategy of Palestine Action and that the raid was aimed at shutting down Elbit and ending what they regarded as British complicity in Israeli war crimes. Funnily enough, they weren't allowed to talk about this during the trial, but the judges, and intimidated into ceasing operations to cause the government to prevent it from operating. The destruction of military assets was one part of a broader and more strategic purpose to shut down Elbit and put pressure on the government. In fact, some of the Elbit plants were shut down. He cited the destruction to things which could not be described as weapons, including the smashing of a disabled toilet and the spraying of paint on the walls.
Well, I mean, the jury were told by the judge, you're not allowed to listen to their arguments in favour of what they've done. What they actually did is they dismissed their lawyers and addressed the jury directly because they were allowed to do that. The jury then convicted, the previous jury had acquitted them all. So they were retried on different charges, which is an abusive process anyway. At the end of it all, the judge should have said to the jury, I'm going to treat this as a terrorism case. So if you find them guilty, I'm going to treat them as terrorists. He didn't tell the jury that. So the jury convicted them of criminal damage. Not of terrorism, criminal damage. But they're going to be sentenced as terrorists, which has got a much, much bigger sentence and much more consequences. Of course, the question is, are they terrorists? Well, that's still being decided in the courts, whether Palestine Action is a terrorist organisation or not. The High Court are still appealing that. Craig Murray has followed all this very closely, and he tried to get Palestine Action's prescription as a terrorist organisation overturned in the Scottish courts, and then he didn't succeed in that.
But we have never, as far as I know, had in this country anybody who's caused criminal damage, which is what these people were charged with, could be classed as terrorists. Actually, what they're doing is they're trying to stop a genocide, which is the opposite of terrorism. 72 protesters have been arrested so far today outside the court in London.
Well, I mean, this is the thin end of the wedge. Don't forget, we're probably going to a major war now, so anybody who speaks out about it could be a terrorist and could be sentenced to long periods in prison. Now, of course, the state can do this, but what it's doing is provoking a lot of people, isn't it? It's very provocative.
So these cases had a terrorist connection, or did they have a pacifist connection?
Well, the legal point I'm making, is that the jury should have been told that they're being tried on terrorism charges. Yeah, you can't then say, we've convicted them of criminal damage, but we're going to sentence them as terrorists. The jury has to be told what the charges are. The jury were convicted of criminal damage. I imagine they're going to appeal and say, look, we've been convicted of criminal damage, but we're being sent down as terrorists. That's abuse of process. If you're going to have a jury, you've got to tell the jury what the charges are. Yeah. So the jury were not informed that this was a terrorism case. If it was a terrorism case, the jury could have then decided, and then, of course, it would have been legitimate.
Martin, terrorism is supplying drones to a genocidal country which is using them to kill women and children and non-combatants. That's terrorism.
I totally agree with you. And anybody who speaks out on behalf of the Israeli occupation forces, which came from the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lehi, which were all terrorist organisations, I might add, didn't just break things. They killed police officers and soldiers and civilians, and they were a terrorist organisation. Anybody who speaks out on their behalf should face 14 years in prison.
Well, Justice Jeremy Johnson is in trouble with lots of lawyers. So I've been hearing this week that our friend Jonathan Cook has been writing about this and explaining that why is it this judge's job, legal profession, revolting against the UK judge, and this guy's name is Justice Jeremy Johnson. I'll just remind you, in case you didn't hear me the first time, that is his job to protect Israel's genocide. That's what Jonathan Cook is saying. And I'll put a link to this article up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Judge Johnson so rigged the trial of anti-genocide activists that thousands of legal professionals have urged him to step down from the sentencing hearing. But Johnson's dirty work is not yet complete, says Jonathan Cook. He goes on to say the trial, the Filton 4, reaches its climax today. The judge, Jeremy Johnson, will decide the sentences of these four Palestine action activists found guilty of criminal damage after two juries refused to convict them of far more serious charges brought by the British government via the Crown Prosecution Service. The Crown Prosecution Service is, of course, a serious problem. This is where our dud Prime Minister came from, according to David Dimbleby. So Starmer's government failed to secure the convictions for aggravated burglary and violent disorder. Of course, they weren't burglaring anything because they were smashing it up. They're not going to smash it up if they're going to burgle something, are they? Seems really obvious. They would have helped retroactively justify the decision to proscribe Palestine Action as a terrorist organisation. The first time in British history that a peaceful direct action group has been so proscribed, ever.
Yes, they're setting precedents here for destroying the rule of law as we go into what may become a totalitarian state.
From the outset, Keir Starmer suggested Israel has the right to withhold food, water and power from 2 million Palestinian residents in Gaza.
Well, that's not what the International Court of Justice says or the International Criminal Court. Now, of course, if we're going to have laws and stuff, they've got to apply across the board. And, of course, they don't. We all know they don't. And the situation is that the state often tries to manipulate the law in order to achieve illegitimate goals.
The BBC's reported this week that the International Criminal Court you were just talking about has suspended its top prosecutor after investigating misconduct allegations. Now, this is the guy... his name is Karim Khan, who the Israelis threatened to kill.
Yes, and of course the allegations against him. I mean, you know, he may have sexually harassed some of his staff. I do not know, but an investigation showed that he hadn't.
Isn't it the case nowadays that many people who are put into these key positions are compromised in some way? And the idea is, if they start to misbehave according to the shadow government, the secret government, the criminal elite, then they can turn the screws and get rid of them.
Well, that's right. So he was regarded by many on the left as, you know, a bit of a softy. He was there, you know, he's a British government appointee. He's probably just going to do what he's supposed to do. And he didn't. He actually went, you know, and that's why they've gone for him. I mean, we all know the way, you know, the law, we need laws, obviously. But the thing is that the law is actually manipulated by the powerful. You know, Ray Cohn, who was Donald Trump's lawyer when he was a young whippersnapper, he was the main lawyer for the mafia in New York. And that is what we're up against. We're dealing with mafia who understand, you know, they want to manipulate the law for their own purposes.
Well, one of the reasons that this trial is all revolving around Bristol and Filton is because we have here, isn't it called Abbey Wood, I think? It's called, not Abbey Wood. I'm not quite sure. I think it is.
Well,
anyway.
Abbey Wood is in Bristol, but there's other things as well.
It's Ministry of Defence procurement. Ministry of Defence are procuring items, I mean, this is one of the major problems, apparently, according to the ministers that have just resigned from the Ministry of Defence, that there's a massive problem with procurement. So there's a massive problem with Bristol, obviously. And it may be that the firms like Elbit and the arms companies like to put themselves in Bristol, if they're not already here, like Rolls-Royce has been for many years, in order to be close to where the MOD are procuring their stuff here in Bristol.
That's right. I mean, Bristol, especially that part of Bristol, is very much dependent on military spending of various kinds. And of course, what may happen, of course, is that the Russians, they've got an election coming up in September, and pressure is on the Russian government to hit back at the place in Swindon, which is now going to be producing drones. And the Russian defense minister, I think it was, gave a list of all the places where these drones are being made, which are being used to attack people in Russia.
Yeah.
I mean, the head of the procurement for the Russians was killed in a car bomb attack last week. I saw that, but you know, most people won't have seen that. The Russians think that that is being carried out by British intelligence. Now, at a certain point, the pressure on the Russian government, and it is a democratic government, they're about to have an election in September, the pressure on them is to hit Britain back and bloody their nose.
We will be hearing from Scott Ritter about this after the break, but also from Bristol Stop the War, I believe this is. This is someone else introducing themselves, saying, "This is Bristol," like we do.
This is Bristol, and it's one of the largest arms manufacturing cities in the whole of Europe. It's home to BAE Systems, which is the dominant arms contractor in Europe, with its largest operations carried out here in the UK and in the US. It's also home to the infamous Elbit Systems, the Israeli arms manufacturer, with weapons made here being used to kill Palestinians in Gaza. We also have Rolls-Royce, which is not just a cars manufacturer, but also a weapons manufacturer, including making parts for the F-35 jets. The University of Bristol has millions of pounds worth of partnerships and research ties with the arms industry, including BAE Systems. It's time to demilitarise education. We should be spending money on public services such as the NHS, schools, housing and transport. Instead, we're spending billions on an arms race that is destined to pull us globally into endless wars and destruction at the expense of the welfare of our societies and the planet. Bristol is just one city. The scale of militarism across Europe and beyond is massive. The need to build unity and opposition to war and imperialism has never been more crucial. Join us for the International Anti-War Conference in London on Saturday the 25th of June. Take a stand against war. The time is now.
Okay, so that's a little Bristol contingent going off to this conference on the 20th of June. That's in, I think, is in a couple of weekends' time. So there is, we have a problem here. They like to call themselves, I'll just point out, that Rolls-Royce aren't making cars. That's been sold off. They actually do make civilian airline engines. So engines for Airbus and Boeing, that sort of thing, but not cars. But yeah, this is they call it systems, don't they? Elbit Systems, BAE Systems. These systems are just turning human beings into profits, money, by killing them.
Yes, and of course, Bristol has, got a fairly radical reputation, but at the same time, we're producing all this weaponry which goes from used to kill people. But these brave young people that are now being sentenced as terrorists have drawn attention to that. Al Cairns and John Healey resigned from the government this week. They just want more money spent on this stuff. Yeah. And of course, what they're trying to do is put pressure on whoever is the Prime Minister, Starmer, or anybody else, to spend more money on weaponry.
Every minister is trying to fight for their own money for budget for their own department, aren't they?
Yes, but I think Cairns in particular, because he's ex-military, don't forget these people end up on the boards of the companies which are supplying this. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if he loses the next election, there's a nice little job for him on the board of BAE Systems. Especially if he's lobbied for them to get some more dosh from us so that we can have a war with Russia, which we don't want. You can see right across the spectrum, you can see that nobody dares to question that we need to spend more on defence. Obviously, Stop the War Bristol say, no, we don't. And I say, no, we don't. If there's no money for anything, the first thing we should cut is supplying weaponry to the Israelis and to provoke the Russians. Because the Russians may well, at some point, not too far away, they may put a missile into that factory. They won't try and kill loads of people, but they'll smash it to bits. Because that's what's happening in Russia. Yeah. We're attacking their stuff. Yeah. But do you remember there was an attack on the nuclear forces by all these drones? Yeah, maybe the Russians at some point are going to say, right, you've been a lot of trouble to us. We are now going to hit your factories. So any work you thought you were going to get out of it, you're not going to do it. We're not going to kill people. There's going to be no factory for you to work in. Now, what are you going to do about it? Because we've got no missiles to fire back with. Yeah, we've got nothing.
Tom, which is back to the Filton trial, Tom Wainwright KC, who was acting for one of the Palestine activists, said redefining direct action protest as terrorism is crossing a Rubicon.
It is. So in other words, anybody who takes direct action against war is now going to be classified as a terrorist.
It would mean he went on. It would mean he went on. Potentially, the suffragettes would be classed as terrorists.
That's right. Of course, it does.
Diane here, HWER, or Deanna here, King's Counsel, speaking for the prosecution, argued that the activist wanted to influence the UK government and Israeli government and encourage the judge to consider the ideology of Palestine Action and its ultimate cause to liberate Palestine from Israel.
Well, I mean, that is an actual statement of fact, but it's not illegal to oppose Israel. Or it wasn't, but, it, you know, what they're arguing is that they were politically motivated, therefore they're terrorists, but they can't be tried as terrorists or as politically motivated because it was criminal damage. So that you can see why any lawyer worth their salt is going to say, well, that just doesn't stack up, does it? Either they're terrorists, in which case you've got to be like, listen to
the legal profession is poking fun at this idea of what this Judge Johnson is up to. But let's have a listen to some of the activists themselves.
Fatma Zainab was on remand for a good 18 months before she actually had her trial. And this is three times the legal custody time limit that unconvicted prisoners, according to the law, should be held in for.
Because the six of us had the terrorism connection hanging over our heads, that meant that our security was managed by the terrorism section of the prison rather than the ordinary security. So there were book bans, withheld mail, my phone calls were threatened to be taken off.
There even came a point where they couldn't even be in the visits hall together at the same time, and therefore the visits were reduced because of this.
The whole point of counter-terror laws in this country is that they're used to override human rights.
On top of that, because Fatma Zainab is visibly a Muslim who wears the hijab, there was a lot of Islamophobia that we've faced as well.
Members of Parliament and the Home Office came out and prejudiced our trial.
The Prime Minister himself in Parliament prejudicing the case, and we had the then Home Secretary also being advised against the CPS to speak out, but doing so regardless.
We were charged with aggravated burglary, violent disorder, and criminal damage.
The first time I saw Judge Johnson in action was at a pre-trial hearing, which was way before their trial started in November 2025.
He removed our defences and stopped that from being reported on, despite the fact he hadn't heard any evidence whatsoever. And he added a terrorism connection and prevented that from being talked about as well.
And because of the withdrawal of defences, we are not able to access Elbit's information for disclosure.
We had expert evidence statements about what Elbit was doing. We had plenty of evidence that they are exporting weapons to Israel and that this is breaking the law, and exactly how these weapons contribute to the genocide. But none of that was allowed to be put in front of the jury.
They thought they could rely on Elbit's security as witnesses, and their credibility was so bad during that trial that even the prosecution examining them proved them to be so inconsistent and incredible that they weren't brought back for the second trial.
Elbit's role in this entire trial was to withhold evidence, not produce it. There was so many incidences of missing footage, which we should have had, and it magically disappeared, most likely because what was actually happening in those cameras was violence from security rather than any damage to weapons.
This tech giant specializing in surveillance isn't able to find their passwords for their main flagship security cameras. It's just, look, you find your own opinions on that, but I think it's ridiculous.
And it's also interesting, isn't it, that most of the witnesses for the prosecution in this case, which is the Crown Prosecution Service, that's the King's own little personal prosecution service and the corrupt organisation that they are, corrupt and Duff, I think it was, the Prime Minister came from, their witnesses were so rubbish that they didn't appear in the second trial at all.
No, and the other thing, of course, is there were loads of CCTV about what actually happened, and it was all what was used in the first trial had been totally edited to try and make them look guilty as charged. Now, in actual fact, what the defence should have been had access to all the CCTV, and of course they weren't. So these are show trials, basically. They should, for criminal damage, they shouldn't have been remanded in custody either. He could send them away with a tag on. They don't have to be in prison. And of course, by keeping them in prison for longer than, as they say, they're not supposed to be in there for more than 6 months, they kept them 18 months, then they're punishing them even if they were found not guilty that have done all that time. Now, in other words, they're doing their best to squash this direct action movement before it can get going. But unfortunately, I think far too many young people are aware now of what's going on, and they are going to be an inspiration.
It's interesting what you said is quite interesting about the idea that this is peaceful, non-violent direct action attempting to shut down this drone factory, Elbit factory in Filton. What may happen is that factory may be bombed, blown up by a foreign power if it's allowed to carry on there.
Well, I think that's unlikely because the Russians won't. The Russians are the ones who might attack us. The Iranians haven't got the capability. Incidentally, of course, the Iranians have been accused by our government and various other governments of being behind anti-Semitic attacks. All these anti-Semitic attacks, it was the Iranians behind it all. And our government and the Australian government, various other governments have all come out and said all these anti-Semitic attacks being orchestrated by Iran. Guess what? I don't believe that. Don't believe it. So what we're dealing with here is a massive manipulation of public opinion and an attempt to intimidate those who stand against
the juggernaut. And also a colossal miscarriage of justice.
Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? All on that day. Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? All on that day. Run from the light, Satan's gonna see you. Run from the light, Satan's gonna see you. Run from the light, Satan's gonna see you. All on that day. Well, don't make a sound, the devil's gonna hear you. Don't make a sound, the devil's gonna hear you. Don't make a sound, the devil's gonna hear you. All on that day. Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Old Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? All on that day. Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? Run to the Lord, Lord, won't you hide me? All on that day. The Lord said, Cinnamon, you should have been a praying. Lord said, Cinnamon, you should have been a praying. Lord said, Cinnamon, you should have been a praying. All on that day. Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? All on that day. The devil said, Cinnamon, step right in. The devil said, Cinnamon, step right in. The devil said, Cinnamon, step right in. All on that day. When you're digging the brown, the devil won't catch you. Digging the brown, the devil won't catch you. Digging the brown, the devil won't catch you. All on that day. Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run? All on that day. Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? Oh, Cinnamon, where you gonna run to? All on that day. Away you gonna run, Cinnamon? Away you gonna run, Cinnamon? Away you gonna run, Cinnamon?
with our children at our feet, and the morals that they worship will be gone. And the men who spurred us on sit in judgment of our own. They decide, and the shotgun sings the song. I took a bow for the new constitution, sitting green at the new revolution, smiling green at the change all around. Pick up my guitar and play just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees and pray. We don't get fooled again.
saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure he was from the House of Lords. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look. Having read the book, I'd love to turn you. My head. Found my way downstairs and drank a cup. And looking up, I noticed I was late. Found my coat and grabbed my hat. Made the bus in seconds flat. Found my way upstairs and had a smoke. And somebody spoke and I went into a dream. And though the holes were rather small, they had to count them all. Now they know how many holes it takes to fill the alcohol.
Every prophet walked this fire.
Every truth cuts through the liar.
Whole world watching, slaughtered daily. Only one says not on my watch, plainly.
We don't bow, we don't sell, we don't buy what you sell. The last wall standing,
that's Iran.
Every child buries
what they've done.
The last wall standing,
that's Iran. We don't bow to bow. A lot of kids on the schedule, call it self-defense. You went bought and sold, the price was immense. Guys are burning, kids dying, cameras on. Every government silent, pockets full, backbone gone. UAE shaking hands,
Saudi counting that check. Wearing Muslim like a costume, but they Zionist projects. Created ISIS, gave them cash in the trucks, but they never touched Zionists.
Man, what the luck?
MBS and MBZ giving bed with Netanyahu. Wild Al Jolani in your pocket playing Muslim for a while. You created fake Islam, put them on the shelf. Sold them to the world like it's the good Muslim self. She asked Sunni, they been pushing that division. But their mom said one, Ummah, that was always the vision. Even Christians know if Jesus walked today, first place he flipped tables.
Tel Aviv, no delay.
Every prophet walked his fire. Every truth cuts through the liar.
Whole world watching, slaughtered daily. Only one says, not on my watch. Plainly, we don't bow, we don't sell, we don't buy. What you sell, the last wall spinning, that's a run. Every child buries what they done. The last wall spinning, that's a run. We don't bow to bow, we never run. Woo! Every treaty sign, they stab the back. Same play, but they used on the native tracks. Billions on propaganda, celebrities on payroll. Still couldn't stop the love for Iran and every free soul. Tired of the ones that lies, the same old spin. We ain't your enemy, we never have been. We pay with our pockets every sanction, every price. We bled for this truth, we didn't think twice. But that empire hearts, man, it's already here. Every conscience that won't sleep is Iran's frontier.
History will remember who stood when it mattered.
Keep your sanctions,
keep your propaganda.
So that's the latest from, or at least one of the latest, from this amazing Iranian production house stroke US, I mean, I suppose, isn't it, what is it, rap? It's something interesting. But anyway, this is where it's at. I mean, I don't know where the chart, what happened to the charts? Because this is the sort of stuff that would be circulating around in the minds of many, many millions of people if it wasn't being suppressed by the blasted algorithms. Anyway, so that was the, what's the actual title of that? Prophets Walk the Fire. So I believe that's the, it's difficult to tell sometimes what the actual title is, but before that we heard A Day in the Life from the Beatles, Sergeant Pepper. So that's what, 1967, is it? Okay, anyway, absolutely brilliant little song, inspired piece of somebody on the YouTube channel has put, you have just listened to the greatest piece of music ever. And of course it is absolutely wonderful in terms of its lyrics and the music too, and its inspiration. Before that we had Pete Townsend singing Won't Get Fooled. I think that was from the Live Aid concert, not quite sure where, but that acoustic version I think is rather nice. That Won't Get Fooled, this is what we keep hearing, isn't it? We heard it from George Bush, we hear it from Donald Trump. This is the sort of rhetoric that's coming out of the United States. Oh, we're not going to get fooled by these Iranians anymore. And that's why I thought it'd be interesting to play that. Also, of course, Pete Townsend's writing also about from The Who is all about, you know, the uprising in the street and the sort of thing that we've been seeing in Belfast, taken to more further extremes when you've got a government that's so utterly corrupt and everyone can see it's corrupt, and people like Starmer won't resign and make way for somebody more sensible. This is just pure political corruption. Before that, we had a quite obscure track from the late 1960s again, Creedence Clearwater Revival. It's brilliant, though. It's from one of my all-time favourite albums, which I was borrowed from Sue Tomalty, who's an young Irish lady I knew at the time, back in the late 80s, it's called Son of Gut Bucket, and it's got absolutely loads of brilliant blues songs on it. That one's Creedence Clearwater Revival with Bootleg, and at the very beginning we had the good old Seekers, 1965, and a song called Cinnamon. So welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Without further ado, I think we should go straight in and hear what Scott Ritter has got to say about the Russian situation. That obviously is getting more and more dangerous by the day as more and more of the NATO countries aid the Ukrainians in actually making direct attacks on non-combatants and on infrastructure facilities in Russia.
I do people-to-people diplomacy. And the fact that I'm here means that people-to-people diplomacy is winning. Because if we were losing, I wouldn't be here. If we were losing, I'd be back at home. Because they would have won. But they're not going to win. Because there are causes, there are beliefs that are more important than war. And those are causes of peace and life and the appreciation of the same. I was a weapons inspector in the Soviet Union with the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. This, in my opinion, was the height of diplomacy. Because what was the INF Treaty at a time when you had American realpolitik, European ideal politic, Soviet national interest coming together in a confluence of interest, deciding that we would not allow nuclear weapons to define our future, that we would take matters into our own hands and eliminate these weapons that threatened not just Europe, but all of the world. Existential survival. Diplomacy works. I know, I lived it, not as a diplomat, but as an implementer of the policies. Later on, I was a weapons inspector in Iraq. When we started our work in Iraq, we tried to model our work on the same procedures that we developed with the INF Treaty, the same concepts. But the thing about the INF Treaty is that the United States and the Soviet Union agreed on objectives. It was a mutually beneficial relationship. But when we spoke about Iraq, there was nothing mutually beneficial about it. It should have been the epitome of multilateralism because it was the Security Council of the United Nations that came together in a Chapter 7 resolution, 687, unanimously to decide that Iraq, as long as it possessed weapons of mass destruction, represented a threat to international peace and security, and we would come together to oversee the disarmament. But what I learned as a weapons inspector that it was never about disarmament. That there was one nation that had a different objective, and that nation was my nation, the United States. We weren't seeking disarmament. We weren't seeking stability. We were seeking to remove Saddam Hussein from power using disarmament as a vehicle to excuse that objective. We didn't want to be honest about what we were trying to achieve. And this began to slide away from, because we're talking about arms control. We're talking about arms race and diplomacy and how it can relate. This was the death of diplomacy when it comes to arms control, because what happened is the concept of, you know, arms control to me is the ultimate expression of human rationality. Think about it. It means that humans are intelligent enough to understand the value of life and the risks that weapons of mass destruction have, and we have a moral compass that guides us to do something about it. And yet, with Iraq, we forgot that. We threw it out the window. It became only about the American hegemon. It became about America's selfish interests above that of the entire world. Now we fast forward to the moment, today. There is no arms control. It's one of the saddest things of my life. I've watched everything I worked for as an adult disappear. There is no more arms control. There are no more arms control treaties between the United States and Russia. There is no multilateralism taking place for disarmament. And the consequences are dire because today we see a new nuclear arms race, including intermediate range weapons that we got rid of. We've gone backwards, not forwards. It's a more dangerous world today than it was. And there is no diplomacy taking place today. None. Not in that important field. And this is the failure of everybody, because again, when we speak of human rationality, it's not just American rationality, it's Russian rationality. Why did Russia abandon arms control? Because it wasn't working? Okay. It wasn't working. Make it work. Don't give up on it, because the consequences of giving up on arms control is death. And that's the ultimate expression of failure. So where do we go from here? It's very difficult when we speak of diplomacy because the United States no longer functions as a rational entity, and Europe is simply an extension of the United States. I agree with you. There is no such thing as Europe. Europe doesn't exist. It's a falsehood. And yet today, Europe is trying to separate itself from the United States. So the subordinate is trying to separate itself from the master, not knowing who and what it is. when I spoke about the ultimate expression of human rationality, the United States today, there is no intellectual foundation for the United States. We do not cherish life. We do not value life. Look at how we behave. We go to war against anybody at the drop of a hat. We have no moral compass. We're only about the accumulation of power, but at least we stand for something. Europe stands for nothing. Europe is just floating there, doing nothing, being nothing, but causing all sorts of trouble. Why? Because the United States, there is hope. When we speak of the future, and this is where diplomacy comes to hand, human rationality, the intelligence to understand the value of life.
So he speaks about America as providing hope, but he's absolutely clear there that the Europe doesn't really exist anymore, even though it does as Brussels and the President of Europe, the Defence Minister of Europe, etc. They're just an adjunct of the United States.
Well, that's right, and there's a real problem in the elites in Europe, including Britain, which is that we want to be subservient to the United States. That's what that all of our policy has been based around it. Andy Burnham, for example, won't be talking about leaving NATO. Of course he won't. But at the same time, the United States keeps dragging us into wars that the ordinary people don't want to fight, either in Russia or Iran. And if, you know, ultimately what the Europeans and the British need to do is get out from under the US control.
But of course, the European Union has announced that it's launching membership talks with Ukraine next week, just as the war with Russia carries on. So they're ignoring the war, and they're saying, well, actually, even though this country's at war, we want it to join the European Union.
Well, in actual fact, the European Union's own rules say that they're not allowed to bring in nations which are at war, especially...
No, I think that's NATO's rules.
No, it's the European Union's rules as well, because, like, you know...
Well, the 27 EU nations, ambassadors, a meeting today, don't agree with you.
Well, what that shows is that the EU doesn't even stick to its own rules. Because it's actually been told, you know, they want the Ukrainians to join, and therefore they're bending all of their rules to allow them to join.
Yeah, they don't actually get audited, do they, either?
No.
For decades.
There used to be something, when I used to work in Eastern Europe in the 90s, we always used to talk about the acquis communautaire, where you have to basically accept all the existing EU regulations, and you've got to move all of your industries and so on to using the same size of screws as we do and all the rest of it. And there's a whole process. You can't join unless you've fulfilled the acquis communautaire.
But the European
but
Union...
now they've just thrown all that out of the window because we want the Ukrainians in the European Union because we know it upsets the Russians, and that's what we're really doing here. We want to upset the Russians.
What a pathetic, pathetic organ. The European Union is saying... I mean, to give them their due. This is what they say, is that for Ukraine to join the European Union is an important security guarantee for a stable future once war with Russia ends.
Yes, and of course the Russians in the past were quite happy for them to join the EU. So if you want to join the EU, you can join the EU, but we don't want you to join NATO. And of course the same thing's happened in Armenia now and in Georgia. If you say you want to join the EU, you've got to start making all of your... you know, phytosanitary regulations, all the regulations about industry have all got to be aligned with the EU. Now, if they're aligned with the EU, they can't be aligned with the Shanghai Corporation or Russian Federation standards, okay? If you start using EU screws in Armenia to make things, then you can't sell that stuff in Russia because we've got different size of screws, yeah? And this is, once you go down that road, there's no turning back. Yeah. What Putin has said to the, because they've just elected Pashinyan in Armenia, who's a pro-Western candidate, he said, okay, you can do that if you want, but we're going to charge you world prices for your energy. Because Armenia is totally dependent on Russian energy, and they get it at a very big discount. Now, if you want to join the EU, that's fine. That's going to double your energy bill. Are you ready for
energy
that?
Energy is what it's all about.
What Putin assessed is you're going to lose about 14% of your GDP. That's what's going to happen.
Now, have there been NGOs in Armenia that have been agitating for them to join?
Yes.
Because this is what they do, isn't it?
That's right. They pay a load of money so that young people can get experience as journalists and activists and so on, all paid for by our taxes. And then they persuade the younger generation in particular, we'd be much better off in the EU and joining the West. And, of course, then they push for that to happen. But the Russians are being fairly cool about it because they've been allied with the Armenia for many, many years. you know, they've got the same orthodox faith.
This could become another Ukraine.
That's the fear. But of course, the Russians are saying, we're not going to say you can't do this, but if you want to join the EU, as you claim, and of course, they're not going to join the EU. Nobody in the EU really wants all the Armenians to come here and take their work, do they? There's no work in Armenia.
Maybe big companies that want cheap labour.
Well, okay, well, we're coming back to that again. But the point is that the Ukrainians would, you know, if the Ukraine was part of the EU, the whole workforce would just up sticks immediately and turn up on our doorstep saying, give us a job. Is that what we want?
Anyway. No, it isn't necessarily. Anyway, part of the problem with the Brussels was really flagged up decades ago by this chap called Rodney Atkinson, who sadly passed away last week. His wife Lynn announced that he died. He had actually had, I believe, a stroke, and so he wasn't very well for the last year or so. But I spoke to Robert Olds this week from the Bruges Group, who knew Rodney pretty well, and I asked him various questions, including about you know, what Rodney was like as a person, because for many years the pair of them had campaigned for British sovereignty and against us joining the EEC, and then after that the EU.
We've had dinner, we've attended conferences together, we'd spoke together at political events in all manner of parts of the country. He was charming, erudite, well spoken, and very nice gentleman. He was very keen for the Bruges Group to support his many campaigns, whether it's the South Molton Declaration or the and the Declaration of British Independence, where he wanted politicians to sign up and commit to supporting Britain's sovereignty and a free and fair referendum, so that we can be a self-governing country again, not under the control of a foreign bureaucracy or foreign courts, for that matter. And this was absolutely crucial to him. That was he was a very caring man and a charming fellow and someone that had gone a long way in spreading the word. And I was pleased to know him and liked him. You know, he'd fallen out with some political people, namely Nigel Farage and the late departed Christopher Booker. He blamed them for him not achieving the leadership of the United Kingdom Independence Party. But he didn't stop his work. He continued.
Yeah, so that's Robert Olds talking about Rodney Atkinson, who he got to know quite well, campaigning against Britain's membership of the European Union and for British sovereignty. But Rodney was blocked and stopped from in his campaign to become the boss of UKIP, and there were quite a lot of other. Robert Olds from the Bruges Group also told me about quite a lot of other as of his work in these various different political parties and campaigns.
Other people in the political world would have certainly known of him and his writings and his work and his activism, but he really did spread the word. And this was a time, you know, in a sense, like in many political movements, they sort of go corporate. Dedicated followers of fashion get involved when there's big money donors. Then people set up campaigns with fancy offices and you know, large budgets, and politicos get involved and cream the benefits off, no doubt believing in the cause they're fighting. Rodney was someone who was very different. He started when it was little known. He was, in a sense, there was a number of lone people who were just very active. There were some lone politicians, Christopher Gill, for instance, who didn't like what was happening, and many other politicians. You know, in a sense, too many to recognize, to name now, but all have had their part to play and been very influential in developing thought in this country and warning of the dangers. And the British people, I think, were instinctively opposed to what was happening with the opinion. They didn't pass the smell test. And Rodney was very influential in explaining those concerns, putting them into words, and exposing what the European Union was all about, and teaming up with people such as Norris McWhirter. And there's a whole host of other people as well who were just campaigning out of their own pocket, researching, writing, spreading the word, because they passionately believed in the cause. There was other people, you may have known Idris Francis, who of course would travel from event to event and ask difficult questions of politicians and expose their hypocrisy and point out where they're lying about Europe. And Rodney Atkinson was using his, undoubtedly very strong intellect and persuasive writing and articulate nature to help spread that word and really helped get the cause going, a cause which is ultimately triumphant in the 2016 referendum, which, 10 years ago now, which you referred to. But of course, we're yet to have the full Brexit that we were actually promised.
Yes, well, I mean, that's the sort of fly in the ointment here, isn't it? That we've had this referendum, voted for Brexit, but what's really changed, Robert?
Well, there are many benefits that have happened. The Bruges Group, the organisation that I run, we've published a book, 75 Brexit Benefits. There's 75, there's actually a few more tangible, real benefits that we've had from exiting the European Union. Some people may disagree with the policy choices of the government, but there have been some important things, and there's one very relevant one as well at this point in time, which is access to aviation fuel outside of the European Union. Britain's airlines can access it cheaper and more easily. That's something, the latest thing that's emerged. There's many different benefits that have come. So there are tangible, real opportunities we've taken advantage of, but we could do much more. And the sovereignty, because this is what Rodney was particularly concerned about, parliamentary sovereignty, and which is how we exercise democracy in this country, was absolutely vital. He didn't have an axe to grind in policy matters when it came to Europe, other than the making the people free and not subject to tyranny. And, tyranny is a very strong word, but when we have 12,000 people a year convicted for speech and thought crimes, there is a very real tyranny. And, Rodney, of course, was less well in the last year of his life, and it's very sad his passing. He must have been absolutely aghast at what's happened and how the political elites are amassing power to suppress freedom, because that's what Rodney ultimately believed in. He believed in the freedom of British people, British men and women, to make their own choices and live their lives as they saw fit, without an overbearing executive, particularly one in a foreign nation, the European Union, governing us and telling us what to do.
So that's Robert Olds again. Martin, it is rather, it's been a bit of a damp squib, you might say, Brexit, even though a lot of the principles were good, that we should be able to kick out politicians in Westminster if we didn't want them. And that's much more difficult to do. In fact, it's impossible to do, really, with the European Commission in Brussels who aren't elected.
Yeah, well, as you know, Tony, I wasn't in favour of Brexit. And if you look at opinion polls now, you'll see that the majority of people realise that it was a bad idea. So we're there. We're not going to go back. The European Union won't have us back because we caused so much trouble in Brexit that we're not going to be allowed back in. So there's no point in discussing it.
What about this long? Well, I think, of course, that there is. And, the mass media also thinks there's no point in discussing anything about Rodney Atkinson, who's the elder brother of Rowan Atkinson, the well-known comedian. These views, along with those of people like Tony Benn and Peter Shaw from the Labour Party, have been completely expunged. They don't exist, apparently.
They haven't been expunged. Basically, we spent years discussing Brexit, Tony.
Maybe hijacked by people like Farage.
Well, the point is that we spent years and years and years talking about Brexit, and us, and people like myself who were opposed to Brexit, we're sick. We were bored with it in the first place, yeah? So we're even more bored with it now. And of course, being as we're going to have a banking collapse and a world war, sovereignty of Britain, not to be told what to do by Brussels, is pretty small beer.
Well, let's have a little listen to Rodney Atkinson now. This is an extract from his talk. And there are a few really good ones. I'll put the full version of this up on our show page if you're interested, because the mainstream press most definitely are not. This is one of those, he's one of those individuals, and this is one of those lines of argument that you are just not allowed to hear on mass media at all.
Was presented with the possibility of signing up to the European Economic Community in 1971. And the government commissioned the Lord Chancellor, Lord Kilmuir, to provide an analysis of what they were signing up for. And of course, even then, it was not signing up to a common market. We know it's long since not been a common market, but even then it wasn't. And Lord Kilmuir said so. Lord Kilmuir said this would be the most extensive and grave sacrifice of national sovereignty ever. And his report was suppressed. Only 30 years later was it published. Such is the betrayal of the British people by the British political establishment. Never ever forget the Kilmuir letter and how it warned these little inadequate politicians of ours that they were destroying our country. They knew what they were doing and they embraced it. There is no excuse. So, in September, on the 9th of September 1993, the late Norris McWhirter and myself laid treason charges, constitutional treason charges, against two ministers, Douglas Hurd and Francis Maud, who were the signatories of the Maastricht Treaty. The treaty had been signed in 1992, and we laid our charges in September 1993. Saying that they had signed away the critical acts of our constitution and our common law and conventions, thoroughly undermining the constitution of the United Kingdom, which according to case law, which we quote, is a treasonable offence. And they did so in 1992. The Crown Prosecution Service, because this was a criminal offence, as well as a constitutional offence, because treason is a criminal charge, and we laid them under so-called misprision of treason. They took 4 months to consider what we laid before the courts. Eventually, Lord Stoddart of Swindon, a Labour peer, stood up in the Lords and asked what the government was doing about the treason charges. And eventually, the Crown Prosecution Service had been told by the Attorney General, a political figure, that no prosecution should take place, their excuse being that in 1993, Parliament passed a law which, even if they had committed treason, the law in 93 made it perfectly legal. Retrospectively making it legal. Nonsense, of course. Complete nonsense. So, we showed that many treason acts, Magna Carta itself, the Act of Settlement, the Coronation Oaths Act, the Act of Union with Scotland, case law in particular R versus Thistlewood, had been all overturned. Now, we just had a great shenanigans about the Scots voting to leave the European Union, United Kingdom. Moronically, they wanted to join the European Union. Self-delusion beyond repair, as old Sir Alfred Sherman used to say. Unbelievable. Never mind. Never mind what the Scots wanted or didn't want. The point is, the Act of Union with Scotland had been overturned, in my opinion, by the illegal act of the Maastricht Treaty, which assigned to other people the rights to make laws in this country. which was against the Act of Union. Because naturally, the Scots united their parliament with us, with our parliament, on the condition that only that parliament would rule.
So that's Rodney Atkinson, an extract from his quite long, I think it's about an hour and 15 minutes presentation. It's called Brexit or Die. Now, I mean, it's what he's saying there effectively is similar to what we're saying about our judicial system today, in with the accusing these peace activists, non-violent direct action people trying to stop a genocide, of being terrorists, is that they've laid all these charges. Hang on, this is treason. You're selling out the sovereignty of the nation to these conservative ministers, and it's all just ignored.
Well, that's because the two cases are quite different. What the actual constitution of the country is, Tony, and we haven't got a written constitution.
Isn't the way that the judiciary works, that is, they just do what they want?
No, it isn't. There are various forces at work in the judiciary and in the political system.
At this top level, you know, surely that's exactly what happens. They've decided they're going to do something, so they just make sure the ministers make sure it happens.
The case he was making there is simply wrong, because in actual fact, the British Constitution isn't written down. The Constitution is the King in Parliament is sovereign. The government of the day, Francis Maud and Douglas Hurd belong to, they absolutely constitutionally decided to sign the Maastricht Treaty, because they are allowed to do that. Any government can overturn any previous decisions and say this is what we're going to do, because they're the elected government.
Okay, and they should really have had a referendum.
No, there's no referendums in the Constitution. We can decide to have a referendum, but you don't have to have one, because the Constitution doesn't say you've got to.
What's so great?
Because we don't have a Constitution.
What's so great about joining the EU? Is it just because it's internationalist?
No, the point I'm making, we're not talking about the actual whether we should or shouldn't have been in the EU. There are going to be different views about that, obviously. Yeah, there's been a big split and a big row about it that's gone on for years and years and years. It's still going on, and we're still, you know, here we are still talking about it. The constitutional position is that the government of the day, if it's been elected under a procedure that we've all recognised, and that's what we generally recognise, the first past the post system is a rubbish procedure, but that's the procedure. They can then make any decision they make, and if they pass it through the House of Commons, that becomes law. That's what parliamentary sovereignty means.
Okay, so you know what? It's funny, because we were hearing just last week, weren't we, about net zero, this law that was passed under Theresa May to say you must have net zero by 2040, 2050 or whatever. Another government can just come along and say, no, we're not.
That's right. I mean, as Tom Paine pointed out years ago when he was part of the American Revolution and then the French Revolution, it's not fair for the previous generations to tell current generations what to do. Any elected democratic government, like the American government in 1776, has got the absolute right to change everything. And, of course, that was a revolutionary government, which came to power through force of arms. But, of course, they were basing what they were saying on the traditional English liberties and all the rest of it. So all this stuff about constitutional rule is a lot of twaddle from twaddly people. The reality is...
Well, I did ask them, actually. I asked them. Norris Goethe and the Freedom Association, these are actually far-right racists, and aren't you and Rodney in bed with them? And so he answered that question, which you can hear in the full interview at thisweek.org.uk later. But finally, I asked him about this. One of the things that Rodney Atkinson helped to dig out and publicise was the relationship between Walter Funk's Europäischen Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft. He was the final wartime Reichsbank chancellor, or head of the Reichsbank in Nazi Germany. The European Union being very similar to the plans that the Nazis had for occupied Europe.
This was actually instituted in 1942, and the German that you spoke is often translated as European Economic Society. Of course, it equally translates as European into English as European Economic Community. This idea of a centralized Europe, it wasn't new. It has historical precedents that go back in time, and different ideologies, particularly intolerant ideologies, which mainly come from the continent of Europe, you know, communism, fascism, Nazism, they come from continental Europe. There's very little to be had that's beneficial from the continental Europe, other than perhaps their food produce. But, you know, dare I say it, English sparkling wine beats actually French champagne in blind taste tests.
Well, I'd rather have Bollinger than English sparkling wine any day. But
Would you dare do a blind taste test about English sparkling wine? Well, I found that quite an interesting thing to say.
Yeah, I want to drink the lot.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
two entire bottles. You can't do that on a taste test. You have to share them out between.
That's what you can share them out between. You used to drink at lunchtime.
You can share
them out. Two entire bottles.
Share them out between Dave and I. I mean, I don't fancy interviewing you when you've had next two Bollinger bottles of champers and, right. And anyway.
Well, no. I mean, there's going to be arguments about whether it was a good or bad idea to join the European Union, or whether it was a good or bad idea to leave.
I think the point is, you know, that there's
people are going to disagree about
it. The point seems to be that elites have decided, and the people have got very little choice. And even though they voted for Brexit in 2016, 10 years ago,
they got it. We've lost 8% of GDP, as Denver pointed out earlier.
Interrupting, but I'm saying that real Brexit hasn't actually happened.
So what would real Brexit look like, Tony?
Well, we would be completely running things. I mean, for example, the stuff Chris Williamson was talking about, we would be running a completely separate economic policy, but we're not. We're doing the same neoliberal stuff as the rest of Europe's doing.
That's because the City of London and the Americans and the Israelis are actually who runs this country.
Maybe we should have a referendum about getting rid of the City of London instead.
Well, we can't do it.
Should we?
We don't need to have referendums about anything necessarily. We need people in charge who know what they're doing.
Yeah, well, they don't know, do they?
Well, no, they do know what they're doing. They're
like
stealing
Chris,
from us.
People that Chris that do know what they're doing are kept out of power. That's the whole point.
Well, he stood against the Labour Party in Derby, having been an MP, and he didn't win against the Labour Party. That's the reality. People voted Labour, they didn't vote
for him. The reality is the press, the media, push the National
Party. That's right. And, of course, the press in this country was massively pro-Brexit. The Daily Mail, the Telegraph, the Times, they were all pro-Brexit. So the idea that there was no pro-Brexit press is rubbish.
I didn't say that, did I?
Well,
anyway,
no,
let's go over to the United States and have a listen to some of the things that we're not hearing about from there. Because our London news media, the so-called fair and free London news media, never tell us anything about the USS Liberty. Do you want to say this is another anniversary of the sinking of the USS Liberty? This is where the Israelis carried out a false flag attack on a US listening ship back in the 1967 Six-Day War.
Yeah, and they killed loads of sailors on the ship. And they were this is all covered up subsequently. What they were trying to do was make if they'd managed to sink the ship with all the sailors on it, they were going to claim that the Egyptians had done it so that the Americans would then join in the war on the Israeli side. That was what they were trying to do. Just as they're trying to do this now, by carrying out attacks on Iran, which the Americans don't necessarily approve of, in order to drag the Americans into a war. This has been going on a long time, and this is far more important than whether Brussels decides the size of sausages. This is warfare.
So this is around about 60 years ago or so. So anyway, this is Senator Massey speaking in US Congress.
We now recognize the gentleman from Kentucky, Mr. Massey, for 5 minutes.
I request unanimous consent to revise and extend my marks and to introduce other material into the record.
Without objection.
Mr. Speaker, it's my great honor, maybe one of the biggest honors of my lifetime, to stand here on the floor and do something that's 59 years overdue, to recognize the survivors and those who gave their lives on the USS Liberty 59 years ago today. When they were viciously attacked by IDF jets and also after that by torpedo boats. I'm going to tell you a little bit of their story. And by the way, there's at least a dozen of them here today with us. I just met with them in my office and they related this story to me. You know, it was a clear day. The USS Liberty was one of the most technologically sophisticated ships in the Navy. But it was virtually unarmed, and it was sent to observe the Six-Day War going on in the Middle East between Israel and its neighbors. It arrived on June 7th, and the weather was clear. The planes came out to meet them, to investigate. And then on the next day, on June 8th, they started the day The visibility was unlimited. The American flag was flying proudly on the USS Liberty. More planes came from Israel to surveil the boat, the ship. And they thought they were in good shape. But what happened next surprised them all. French Mirage jets showed up and for 25 minutes strafed and attacked the USS Liberty. They shot rockets. They shot 30-millimeter cannons into the hull and into the ship. They even dropped napalm on the bridge of the ship. This was an effort to kill everybody on board. There was no intention of taking prisoners. After the 25 grueling minutes of attack on this virtually unarmed ship, and they thought things were over and they could recover, the torpedo boats showed up, three torpedo boats. They launched four torpedoes. One of them hit the hull of the USS Liberty and killed 25 people instantly. It blew a 40-foot by 40-foot hole in the side of this ship. They were intent on sinking it. But they were also intent on not having a single survivor. According to eyewitness accounts, the Israelis machine gunned the lifeboats that they put down. They machine gunned the firefighters who were on the deck. They were bringing the wounded and the dead to the mess hall to triage them. They had one doctor who was trying to help them all, put a few stitches in. It was harrowing, and it's amazing. If not for that crew, that boat would have sunk that day. But it still wasn't over. Helicopters showed up, combat helicopters. And the USS Liberty, even though their signals were being jammed by the Israelis, got a signal out. And there were ships that tried to respond. The USS Saratoga, the USS America sent planes. Both of them sent planes to help the USS Liberty. And something happened that's never happened before. A ship under attack, the planes were recalled. This has never happened before. And they sat there for 17 hours. 34 dead, 174 wounded. Out of 294 crew members. That's over 70% casualty rate, unheard of. The Israelis were intent on leaving no survivor. And what about our own military? Why did they not send anybody for 17 hours to help these men? So what really happened? You know, the official reports say that it was a case of mistaken identity. But if you listen to Dean Rusk, former Secretary of State, Richard Helms, CIA Director, Bobby Ray Inman, head of the NSA, Captain Ward Boston, who was the chief counsel of the Court of Inquiry. If you listen to Admiral Moore, who served in Pearl Harbor, Midway, commanded both the Atlantic and Pacific Fleet, and was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, none of these distinguished men think this was an accident. They think it was intentional murder by the country of Israel, either as a false flag operation or because they simply didn't want anybody observing what they were doing that day.
So that's just a part of the speech by Congressman Massey. Martin, just after we started playing that clip, you were explaining that Massey has been under massive attack over in the United States. He's a Republican congressman, and there have been moves, even though he's still a congressman now, to make sure that when it comes to the primaries, he's out.
Yeah, well, they've had the primary in Kentucky. I think he's from Kentucky. And the AIPAC and the Israeli lobby chucked millions of dollars. I think it's the most expensive primary in US history. And they've managed to get him out. So he won't be allowed to stand in the November election for the Republican Party. And of course, if you can't stand through the Republican or the Democrats in the US, you're at a massive disadvantage because everybody has to register either as a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. And in many states, you can't get other than Republicans and Democrats onto the ballot paper. So it's a one-party, two-party system, but it's a one-party system. And he's out because precisely because of that sort of thing, where he's forensically discussing Israel's terrorist behavior in 1967, they don't want him in Congress. So he's not going to be
there. It reminds me a little bit of this attack that the Israelis did on the medics, where they actually then got bulldozers and tried to bury all the evidence. They were trying to make sure that ship was sunk and all the evidence was buried at the time.
That's right.
This is way back in the 1960s.
They didn't quite manage that. And of course,
it's an act of providence that this ship managed to survive all these attacks, in a way.
Yes, I know, but in a way, it's they got what they wanted because it was all covered up. I mean, we're covering it now, but of course, everybody in the US I ought think to know that the Israelis sank your ship and killed loads of your sailors.
For me, this is one of the main reasons we do this program, is because information like this is utterly suppressed by the mass news media, whether it's Washington or London. But the thing is, people have understood this about US imperialism and the way it operates and in cohorts with the Israelis and the British for many years. And here's one of them, also from the 1960s, talking about that.
You've lived all over the place and all over the globe, and then you, for a long time when you were not in this country, then you suddenly came back. What opinion do you have of some of the generalizations that are made about the country, that there's something violent in the American character, for example, or that
there is,
or that the country's...
I think there is, don't you? I think there always has been, though.
Yeah.
I think it's part of our whole story.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that is generally true, the one generalization which is true about America, is that everything is true about it. Yes. It's impossible to say anything that isn't true, good or bad. Our enemies are right, our friends are right.
Yes.
It's an awful big country, an awful lot of different kinds of people in it, and violence always has been part of our story. It is, you know, I've seen it in my own lifetime long before this period, and we certainly read about it in history. That's the way we won the country and stole it away from the Indians and all the rest of it.
Is it? I wonder why it should be, though. There's any reason why the English, if they had had Indians in England before they were Englishmen there,
well,
that they
had
have
some Indians in India.
Yes, they did, didn't they?
Yeah. And they had those kind of folks all over, and they, in some places, they brought the law and justice. And I've talked to people in other ex-colonies. Nice people, when you mention the British, burst into tears of anger, literally tears of rage, about our nice English cousins. So the bad things are true about them. They burnt the roofs off of the Irish and starved them out into the cold. There's nothing that you can think of that the English didn't do to that island right next door to them, to the Irish, over a period of 700 years. And we're English. And then we added a lot of other violent mixtures to the brew. I think man is a crazy animal.
Yeah.
I think we're also marvelous people, divine in our potentialities. You see, there you are. You can say anything with passion and get a hand.
So that's obviously Orson Welles there talking back in the 1960s about this connection between the British and the American imperialists, Martin.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear. Anybody who knows anything about history is that the US is the illegitimate child of the British Empire. And, of course, Cecil Rhodes, who I'm reading about at the moment in a book I'm reading, which I won't bore everybody with, his idea was that, that the British would infiltrate the US Empire, and between us we would dominate the world. And, of course, that is the ideology currently dominant in the US.
One of those campaigning for the Palestinians we have on this program fairly regularly is Tony Greenstein. Anyway, it turns out that not only has he got court cases against him, he's having to fight at the moment. I think he's one of the great heroes. He's one of the, I think he is the first person to be a Jew to be expelled from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism. He's also one of the founders of the UK Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and as such, he's being horrendously targeted. Here he is speaking on Crispin Flintoff's program last Sunday about his having his bank accounts frozen too, just for campaigning for the poor Palestinians who are being hammered and massacred.
Now, I saw a story that your bank account has been frozen, is that right?
That's right, not just my bank account, but the account of a charity, the Brighton Trust, and four associated accounts. But let's put this in perspective. I mean, I don't have any time for Wes Streeting, but it's clear that he put a paper to Cabinet about the horrific destruction of hospitals, the lack of anaesthetics that Israel had blocked, etc. And the rest, the majority of the Cabinet, including Starmer, were not interested, which shows us that Starmer is deliberately feeding a genocide, and anyone who opposes that, who becomes an irritant to the state, is targeted. And that's really what's happened, because I think it's a national crime agency has been contacting banks, not just to me, but others as well, including, I believe, Defend Our Juries. It's a very insidious way of attacking your political opponents, and they're using it through money laundering legislation. So it's legislation designed for something entirely different, which is now being used to target political opponents. And the nature of the legislation, it says the banks can't disclose what the allegations are or who has made them. So it's totally Kafkaesque. We have to kind of read the tea leaves, as it were, to see who might be behind this. I mean, my barrister has said he thinks it's basically contempt of court, because you're harassing someone who's on trial. So it's like harassing a witness, for example. I mean, it's completely underhand, dirty tricks. But given I've got a trial on terrorism, of course, no one suggests I am a terrorist, because even the police gave me bail without any objection. But so it's about free speech. But if you say the wrong things today.
So effectively what they're suggesting is you're a money laundering terrorist, Tony.
The only possibility is that our charity sends every month up to £4,000 to a Palestinian kindergarten in Jenin, which is heavily under occupation. There are soldiers who enter the centre with guns at the ready. They beat people up in the street for no reason. They set dogs on children. A little child was bitten and had to go to hospital. They do all sorts of things. They destroy water. They vandalise anywhere. I mean, like, it was Eid last week, the festival, so they destroyed toy shops so kids couldn't have toys. I mean, they're really sadistic monsters, the soldiers who patrol. I mean, it's a military occupation. And this is being supported by our government. If you send money to relieve some of the distress, that's automatically suspicious.
Well, I mean, Tony Greenstein is a man of great integrity and courage, and also, as you say, the first Jew to be expelled from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism. And of course, as you pointed out, I mean, having, preventing accessing his bank account is an administrative measure. He's not been convicted of anything. And of course, that just means that we've decided you're a terrorist, so you can't have access to your own money.
It's very similar to the interview we did with James Tweedy a few weeks ago, who's he's got his general current account with the Nationwide Building Society. He's also been being paid from Lebanon into that building society, and they've just contacted and said, well, we've decided we're going to freeze the entire account because we're suspicious about where this money is coming from in Lebanon, and it may be related possibly to sanctioned individuals or countries. And we're going to freeze your entire bank account.
Well, both Hezbollah and Hamas have been labelled terrorist organisations in this country, but there's not been any discussion or vote about it. It's just the government's decided you're a terrorist organisation. I would say the Israeli occupation forces are a terrorist organisation. As I said earlier, they were founded by terrorists, the Irgun, the Haganah, the Lehi, all of them terrorists, and the Israeli occupation forces are the direct descendants of those terrorist groups, so that anybody who sends any money to them or has anything to do with them is obviously a terrorist, and they should have their bank account.
Well, this organisation that seems
we're going to
be
go for people like this,
this
Kafkaesque
organisation, which I think deserves a lot of scrutiny. It needs a panorama, please, on Monday, all about it. Are called OFSI, OFSI, which I'm not quite sure what it stands for. But OFSI, it's their job apparently to say freeze this account, keep pointing the fingers. If there is some suspicion that somebody is dealing with a sanctioned country or organisation, it's a part of the National Crime Agency, which is Britain's FBI, apparently. Yeah. But they don't have to explain anything about it. They just freeze
it. Because there's no due process involved in any of it, is it? It's just
financial
an administrative decision.
Office is called the Office of Financial Sanctions Implementation.
Well, there's a big question about whether there should be sanctions on anybody about anything. You know, who decides who gets sanctioned?
Well, one person that's definitely not sanctioned is a guy called Elon Musk. And you mentioned right at the very start of the program about him, this flotation of his SpaceX company, which apparently is one of the biggest in history. Do you want to just explain?
Well, it is the biggest in history. And at the end of it, he's going to be the first trillionaire in history.
Maybe. And or maybe he's going to lose it all.
Well, maybe he will lose it all. But of course, what he's actually doing, he's on Twitter telling us we need to riot more.
Well, anyway, Bloomberg did have a look at that this week.
The ambitions for this business are so huge, going to the moon and going to Mars.
It really is. And it's interesting because I've covered this company for quite some years now. So to watch it grow into something that could potentially make Elon Musk a trillionaire is quite something. And at the very start, you know, they founded in 2002. And there was a lot of skepticism as to how they were actually going to get to this point. And now they're actually, you know, just about to launch to Mars. So we've come from a place where they were launching Falcon 9 rockets into orbit that were exploding. They were failing. There was a point where they were maybe never going to come back from this. And now they're launching, they're doing this IPO, going public, and it's huge, and it's taken investors by such surprise and excitement. And this is really what we're seeing today. You know, this is sort of evidence that Elon Musk is growing this company, not from, you know, just rocket launches, but also satellite constellation. He's got his Starlink constellation up there. Launches to the moon, to Mars, and potentially beyond. It's all down to Elon Musk's ambition, really. We've also seen that they want to launch data centers in space. So this is something that we've never seen before. So what they're going public with is something that we're not really sure how it's going to work out. But if they started in 2002 with something that people were not sure what was going to happen, you know, it's quite possible that this could be a real success.
Well, I mean, that's just a puff piece, isn't it, for the whole thing?
It is. It's an advert, really, by Bloomberg. Bloomberg, I'm sure, will be taking their cut from this $1.3 trillion flotation.
Yes. What I've been reading is that he's got loads of Duff AI shares. Some of the Starlink stuff is probably viable, but he's got loads and loads of other things that he's bought which aren't viable, but he's put them all into the same company so they could all, in fact, effectively go bust. But I mean, can't people see that this is like the South Sea bubble? We're going to build things on Mars. Give me your money. Now, can't people see what's wrong with that? Are we ever going to build things on Mars? I don't think we are. Just as the South Sea bubble isn't going to do loads of things in the South Seas.
One of the things that's not really mentioned here is that actually Elon Musk is a branch of the American military.
That's right.
His Starlink system is used for killing people.
That's right. That's true. And of course, what the Iranians have started doing, and as part of their escalation strategy, is they're going to knock out Palantir and Musk and all of these other tech bros. Boast about how they're definitely in charge of they're going to be really, really embedded in the US military. That means that all of your facilities are military targets. Okay? Have you told your insurance companies about this? And of course, this is exactly what the Iranians have been doing. They've been knocking out data centers.
At some point, the bottom may just fall out of the stock market.
That's right.
And I mean, the other thing, of course, with Musk is Tesla companies made an absolute fortune with these electric vehicles, knowing, of course, as we kept intimating over the years, and when it first happened in February, and the first program I think we had in the beginning of March, Martin, I said to you, have you bought your electric car yet? Because, of course, he knows that there's going to be threats to the oil supply by America. American warships blowing up the engine rooms of tankers and this sort of thing. So hence, he knows that his electric car company is going to be doing rather well. So this guy is basically the ultimate inside dealer. And not only that, he's controlling the narrative through his rather rubbishy thing called X.
Well, yes, I mean, he's not just doing one thing. He's not like Henry Ford building cars, is he?
He's Mr. Technocracy Inc. Anyway, look, I'd just like to wind up with a look at the First World War and the Second World War. This is, I suppose, looking at how these wars are created, looking, of course, at the next war, whatever is happening with that, when it's taking place. It already seems to be starting, as I think I said, 15 weeks now of the Third World War, which seems to be obvious to me to be a Middle East conflict between Israel and Iran, bringing in the Americans, then possibly bringing in the Russians, possibly bringing in China and other superpowers. and causing absolute devastation. It just seems to me it's all obvious. That's what's the plan is just unfolding before our eyes. But we're maybe slightly ahead of things by seeing what's about to happen rather than just reacting. We don't have to do that. But let's, as part of that, go back right the way back to the time of the First World War and to hear from this chap, Benjamin Friedman. He does a very, very strong, he's a Jewish guy, he gave a very strong anti-Zionist speech at the Willard Hotel in Washington back in 1961.
1914 was the year in which World War I broke out. There are a few people here my age who remember that. Now, that war was waged on one side by Great Britain, France, and Russia, and on the other side by Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. What happened? Within 2 years, Germany had won that war. Not alone won it nominally, but won it actually. The German submarines, which were a surprise to the world, had swept all the convoys from the Atlantic Ocean, and Great Britain stood there without ammunition for her soldiers, stood there with 1 week's food supply facing her, and after that, starvation. At that time, the French army had mutinied. They lost 600,000 of the flower of the French youth in the defense of Verdun on the Somme. The Russian army was defecting. They were picking up their toys and going home. They didn't want to play war anymore. They didn't like the Tsar. And the Italian army had collapsed. Now, Germany, not a shot had been fired on the German soil. Not an enemy soldier had crossed the border into Germany. And yet, here was Germany offering England peace terms. They offered England a negotiated peace on what the lawyers call a status quo ante basis. That means, let's call the war off and let everything be as it was before the war started. Well, England in the summer of 1916 was considering that seriously. They had no choice. It was either accepting this negotiated peace that Germany was magnanimously offering them or going on with the war and being totally defeated. While that was going on, the Zionists in Germany, who represented the Zionists from Eastern Europe, went to the British War Cabinet, and I'm going to be brief because this is a long story, but I have all the documents to prove any statement that I make. If anyone here is curious or doesn't believe what I'm saying is at all possible, the Zionists in London went to the British War Cabinet and they said, look here, you can yet win this war. You don't have to give up. You don't have to accept a negotiated peace offered to you now by Germany. You can win this war if the United States will come in as your ally. The United States was not in the war at that time. We were fresh. We were young. We were rich. We were powerful. And they told England, we will guarantee to bring the United States into the war as your ally, to fight with you on your side, if you will promise us Palestine after you win the war. In other words, they made this deal. We will get the United States into this war as your ally. The price you must pay us is Palestine after you have won the war and defeated Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. Now, England had as much right to promise Palestine to anybody as the United States would have to promise Japan to Ireland for any reason whatsoever. It's absolutely absurd that Great Britain, that never had any connection or any interest or any right in what is known as Palestine, should offer it as coin of the realm to pay the Zionists for bringing the United States into the war. However, they made that promise in October of 1916. October 1916. And shortly after that, I don't know how many here remember it, the United States, which was almost totally pro-German, because the newspapers here were controlled by Jews, the bankers were Jews, all the media of mass communications in this country were controlled by Jews, and they were pro-German because their people, in a majority of cases, came from Germany, and they wanted to see Germany lick the Tsar. The Jews didn't like the Tsar, and they didn't want Russia to win this war. So the German bankers, the German Jews, Kuhn Loew, and the other big banking firms in the United States, refused to finance France or England to the extent of $1. They stood aside and they said, as long as France and England are tied up with Russia, not 1 cent. But they poured money into Germany, they fought with Germany against Russia, trying to lick the Tsarist regime. Now, those same Jews, when they saw the possibility of getting Palestine, they went to England and they made this deal. At that time, everything changed, like the traffic light that changes from red to green, where the newspapers had been all pro-German, where they'd been telling the people the difficulties that Germany was having fighting Great Britain commercially and in other respects. All of a sudden, the Germans were no good. They were villains. They were Huns. They were shooting Red Cross nurses. They were cutting off babies' hands, and they were no good. Well, shortly after that, Mr. Wilson declared war on Germany. The Zionists in London sent these cables to the United States, to Justice Brandeis, go to work on President Wilson. We're getting from England what we want. Now you go to work, and you go to work on President Wilson and get the United States into the war. And that did happen. That's how the United States got into the war. We had no more interest in it. We had no more right to be in it than we have to be on the moon tonight instead of in this room. Now, the war, World War I, in which the United States participated, had absolutely no reason to be our war. We went in there, we were railroaded into it. If I can be vulgar, we were suckered into that war merely so that the Zionists of the world could obtain Palestine. Now, that is something that the people in the United States have never been told. They never knew why we went into World War I. Now, what happened? After we got into the war, the Zionists went to Great Britain, and they said, well, we performed our part of the agreement. Let's have something in writing that shows that you are going to keep your bargain and give us Palestine after you win the war. Because they didn't know whether the war would last another year or another 10 years. So they started to work out a receipt. The receipt took the form of a letter, and it was worded in very cryptic language so that the world at large wouldn't know what it was all about. And that was called the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was merely Great Britain's promise to pay the Zionists what they had agreed upon as a consideration for getting the United States into the war. So this great Balfour Declaration that you hear so much about is just as phony as a $3 bill, and I don't think I can make it more emphatic than that. Now, that is where all the trouble started. The United States was in the war. The United States crushed Germany. We went in there, and it's history. You know what happened. Now, when the war was ended, and the Germans went to Paris, to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, there were 117 Jews there as a delegation representing the Jews, headed by Bernard Baruch. I was there, I ought to know. Now what happened? The Jews at that peace conference when they were cutting up Germany and parceling out Europe to all these nations that claimed a right to a certain part of European territory, the Jew says, how about Palestine for us? And they produced, for the first time, to the knowledge of Germans, this Balfour Declaration. So the Germans, for the first time, realized, oh, that was the game. That's why the United States came into the war. And the Germans, for the first time, realized that they were defeated. They suffered this terrific reparations that was slapped onto them because the Zionists wanted Palestine. And they were determined to get it at any cost. Now, that brings us up to another very interesting point. When the Germans realized this, they naturally resented it. Up to that time, the Jews had never been better off in any country in the world than they had been in Germany. You had Mr. Rathenau there, who was maybe 100 times as important in industry and finance as Bernard Baruch in this country. You had Mr. Balin, who owned the two big steamship lines, the North German Lloyd and the Hamburg American line, thank you. You had Mr. Bleichsröder, who was the banker for the Hohenzollern family. You had the Warburgs in Hamburg, who were the big merchant bankers, the biggest in the world. The Jews were doing very well in Germany. No question about that. Now, the Germans felt, well, that was quite a sellout. It was a sellout that I can best compare. Suppose the United States was at war today with the Soviet Union. And we were winning. And we told the Soviet Union, well, let's quit. We offer you peace terms. Let's forget the whole thing. And all of a sudden, Red China came into the war as an ally of the Soviet Union. And throwing them into the war brought about our defeat, a crushing defeat, with a reparations the likes of which man's imagination cannot encompass. Imagine, then, after that defeat, if we found out that it was the Chinese in this country, our Chinese citizens, who all the time we thought they were loyal citizens working with us, were selling us out to the Soviet Union, and it was through them that Red China was brought into the war against us. How would we feel in the United States against Chinese? I don't think one of them would dare show his face on any street. There wouldn't be lampposts enough convenient to take care of them. Imagine how we would feel. Well, that's how the Germans felt towards these Jews. We've been so nice to them, and from 1905 on, when the first communist revolution in Russia failed and the Jews had to scramble out of Russia, they all went to Germany, and Germany gave them refuge, and they were treated very nicely. And here, they sold Germany down the river for no reason at all, other than they wanted Palestine as a so-called Jewish commonwealth. Now, Nahum Sokolow, all the great leaders, the big names that you read about in connection with Zionism today, they, in 1919, 1920, 21, 22, and 23, they wrote in all their papers, and the press was filled with their statements, that the feeling against the Jews in Germany is due to the fact that they realize that this great defeat was brought about by our intercession and bringing the United States into the war against them.
So that's Benjamin Friedman speaking in 1961 at the Willard Hotel. So, Martin, he's absolutely clear, Friedman, about making this important distinction between Zionism and Judaism. He argued the modern political Zionism is a secular geopolitical movement, not an expression of authentic religious Judaism as well. What he's saying there about the First World War, I think, is pretty incredible version of history. And he says, I was there at Versailles. I know, that's why I know about this.
Well, I think it's a very if I put it this way, it's a Jewish eye view of history. The Jews in this, Montague, who was the only cabinet member, so who was Jewish in Britain at the time, he was the only cabinet member to oppose the Balfour Declaration, because he said this is bad for the Jews. It'll lead to a situation where Jews like myself were settled in this country.
And as he said there, this is where all the trouble started.
Yes, but the Jews in general were actually quite hostile to the Balfour Declaration. The Zionists were a tiny minority, an extremist minority. And of course, what had happened is in the minds of people like Lloyd George and Churchill, because they were quite anti-Semitic, both of them, was that they have this idea that if they gave the Balfour Declaration to the Zionists, that would mean that they would use their power to try and make the Americans do this and that and the other. Montague, who was the only Jew in the cabinet, said, well, I'm opposed to this for various reasons, not least because it's bad for Jewish people. We don't want to go there. Most of us are not interested in any way, shape or form of going to Palestine.
So, I mean, what amazes me is, it's like from hearing from Tony Greenstein, this whole attempt to merge Zionists and Judaism is partly what led to the pogroms against the Jews in Nazi Germany. Just an understanding that Zionism is not the same as Judaism.
Yes, but as you know, Tony, both the Nazis and the Zionists actually collaborated at one stage, which is why Ken Livingstone...
Well, in the Second World War, the Zionists actually broke the boycott of Nazi Germany.
That's right. So in the 30s, they were cooperating. Because as Theodore Herzl said, the anti-Semites are our natural allies, because they will be nasty to Jews and then we'll persuade them all to come to Israel. In actual fact, most Jews do not want to live in Israel even now. They live elsewhere. There's a tiny minority of them live in Israel. Most of them Jews live elsewhere. And they're not necessarily pro-Zionists.
And many sane, sensible Israelis are looking to get out of Dodge.
That's certainly what seems to be the case.
So it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks also to Robert Olds and Chris Williamson. We'll be hearing from Uwe Alshiner next week, I hope. And also, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Please download this show as an MP3, if you like, from 11 p.m. tonight to listen in the car or anywhere you like. And follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram, where we have all sorts of stuff going on there during the week, including that amazing tune we heard from the Iranians earlier on. Do please share interviews and story tips on that Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel, WhatsApp and elsewhere. You can get all the information, including the app. Get download this app on Apple or Android via thisweekoneword.org.uk. And you can also get the weekly newsletter through that too, which has been, I've been dishing out some interesting bits and bobs as attachments to that over the last few weeks too. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when you can hear the glorious Richie Allen show live. We're streaming live now from Bristol, just about still, on the talkradio.org.uk stream at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com at 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream this show live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
talk like Marlene Dietrich, and you dance like Zizi Jarmet. Your clothes are all made by Balmain, and there's diamonds and pearls in your hair. Yes, there are. You live in a fancy apartment off the boulevard Saint-Michel, where you keep your Rolling Stones records and a friend of Sacha Distel. Yes, you do. But where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head. Yes, I do. I've seen all your qualifications you got from the Sorbonne, and the painting you stole from Picasso. Your loveliness goes on and on. Yes, it does. When you go on your summer vacation, you go to Juan-les-Pins with your carefully designed topless swimsuit. You get an even suntan on your back and on your legs, and when the snow falls, you're found in Samoritz with the others of the jet set, and you sip your Napoleon brandy, but you never get your lips wet. No, you don't. But where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Won't you tell me the thoughts that surround you? I want to look inside your head. Yes, I do. Your name, it is heard in high places. You know the Aga Khan. He sent you a racehorse for Christmas, and you keep it just for fun, for a laugh. They say that when you get married, it'll be to a millionaire, but they don't realize where you came from, and I wonder if they really care or give a damn. Where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head. Yes, I do. I remember the back streets of Naples, two children begging in the rags, both touched with a burning ambition to shake off their lowly bone takes, so they try. So look into my face, Marie Claire, and remember just who you are. Then go and forget me forever, but I know you still bear the scar deep inside. Yes, you do. I know where you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed. I know the thoughts that surround you, 'cause I can look inside your